Out now from RLJ Entertainment, All the Creatures Were Stirring, from director Rebecca McKendry, who is our very own co-host on the show, and we're all very, very proud of her. In the film, a young couple struggling through their first date on Christmas Eve end up in a spooky theater where they are shown several bizarre and twisted Christmas tales, all featuring scenes of holiday horror. The film stars Constance Wu, Jonathan Kite, Amanda Fuller, Jocelyn Donahue, Graham Skipper, Ashley Clements, Megan Duffy, and many more. All the Creatures Were Stirring is out now on Redbox, and it is out now on VOD, and it will be hitting Shudder on December 13th, so keep an eye out for it, everybody, and stay tuned for later in this episode. We'll have some more All the Creatures Were Stirring fun.
Tonight's Shockwaves is also brought to you by Shudder. AMC Network Shudder is a premium streaming video service, super serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing fantastic, irreverent reviews to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes there's safety in numbers. Don't be left in the dark alone. You can stream great thrillers, horror, and suspense for $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. Shudder also has the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of thrilling and dangerous entertainment. Some people call it the Netflix of horror, but it's better than that. To try Shudder free for 30 days, go to shudder.com/podcast and use the promo code WAVES. And that's Shudder, S-H-U-D-D-E-R.
And now on Shudder is Mandy. Now on Shudder is
Satan's Sleeve. Terrified.
If you haven't seen the Joe Bob Briggs Thanksgiving special, I highly recommend you do.
He played my trailer and I about passed out. I was watching it at home and all of a sudden I was like, he's fucking showing my trailer. It was amazing.
I'm going to predict now, because I know next week is our top 10 of the year, I bet at least half are on Shudder of mine already. So there you go. Shudder.
Okay, welcome to episode 125 of Shockwaves. The whole gang is back.
Oh my gosh, guys. Hi. I missed you all.
There we go. There's our host, Rebecca McKendry.
Hi, guys.
Welcome. Thanks. Ryan Turek's here.
Hello.
Elric Kane.
Hi.
Hi. And I'm Rob G.
Yeah, you are.
And together we form Voltron.
The Voltron of horror.
I'm the arm.
You're the arm?
I want to be the arm.
I'm the pink one. I'm hoping there's a pink one still.
And I'll form the head. That was what one of them always said at the end.
We just form some weird Dagon-like creature. By the way, what the fuck, guys?
Diss on Dagon while I'm gone.
Diss on it.
Well, actually, Ryan kind of did. I didn't diss on it.
I was just saying it didn't hold up like I wanted it to. That's all. I mean, I still respect it and I'll still watch it. And I'm still owning it.
Okay. I will agree that the lead actor in it is a little. He's a little theatrical.
He's no Graham Skipper, is what we're saying.
And that's why the best thing to come out of last episode is that we need to CG Graham Skipper into all of Stewart's movies.
Oh, really? You know what? I'll take that.
Castle Freak Graham Skipper is pretty cool.
I cast Graham Skipper in my movie because I love Graham Skipper so much. So, yeah.
That's an easy segue. I like it.
Well, it's nice to have everybody back.
Yeah.
I just want to preview. This is the second to last episode of 2018. Mm-hmm. Next week, we're going to have a pretty stellar episode. I mean, this one's going to be stellar too. But next week is our year-end blowout special, where we're all going to be coming to the table talking about great things that we. Yes.
Yeah. I'm pointing to Ryan. That's why he's slowing down. This should be interesting because basically. We'll discuss in between this episode and next, but basically, normally you do your top 10 films of the year.
Yeah, we got to set rules this time.
Because people have plopped in shows and things like that. Elric's still sticking to that because if you hear his other podcast, he is a list man. He sticks to the list and that's that. But Ryan put a nugget in my head, and I think I'm going to go with your nugget, which is
top 10
I just want my top 10 favorite things.
Yes. Okay.
Because
I have a lot of things.
But what else is there? my top 10 things will besides, still be 10 films.
Besides, no, besides cinema? Like,
I think that that definitely opens it up a little.
I've been very
on that.
So everyone's number one is sex.
Sex, movies. What else is there? Come on. And they're all kind of the same when you think about it.
No, but I think that could be fun. I think Ryan's going for that assignment too.
Yeah, yeah, right? And I think that that will help clear up a lot of things because, like, I remember 2 years ago I put a TV show on the list and you guys tried to kill me, but then Elric did it last year for Twin Peaks, and I think we tried to kill him, but
television.
We were slightly... But
David Lynch isn't television.
Oh, get out of here.
But it still is not a film. And then, like, this year, though I plan to binge it this week, like, Hell House, is that going to be, you know, is that TV? Is it film?
It's one of your favorite things. Just put it on the list.
And I already said to people, like, you're not going to do a top 10 list. You suck. It's like you guys ruined October, and now you're not doing top 10 lists.
Can we do
no
both?
Way.
I could also see the same show. We could do 10 10 things.
Listen, I just liked mixing it up.
I'm going to come to the table with all of the great things that brought joy to my life.
Okay.
And that includes you,
fucking
Rebecca,
new age Turek.
Oh my God.
Since you went to that retreat,
Turek
come
is
back
like
all,
a cult leader now. Did you just hear
drinking
that?
Drinking Perrier water and
I went to a retreat.
Did you?
No,
I just made that up.
I've been doing cryo, though. I've been doing cryotherapy a lot.
Oh, really? Oh, my God. Seriously, is it working?
Oh, that's fantastic.
So one of the guys that I write with a lot does cryo, and I'm always like, seriously?
Wait, cryogenics? Like you're being frozen?
Like you go in.
You go into a locker, or not a locker. You go into
It's like a tanning bed.
It's like a shower stall.
It's
a
stand-up tanning bed.
Yeah, it's a stand-up tanning bed, and the temperature drops to 150 degrees below zero.
And you stay in it for like buck naked for a couple minutes, and then you hop out.
Shrinkage.
You protect that. You protect that.
That's what comes to
I think
mind.
You're spending that Halloween money, yo. Yo, Walt Disney all up in here.
Yeah.
Anyways.
That was very LA of you, Church. You're doing cryo.
I know it is.
Wow.
So silly. So anyways, next week, look for maybe a double-sized episode.
I will say your skin's never looked better. Like being up close next year, it's kind of HD.
You're glowing. Have you been
everybody
getting
across
buffing?
The country is just rolling their eyes right now. Let's get into some horror movies, shall we?
I don't know. I like this beauty treatment stuff.
Rob, what do you got?
I got a lot of stuff, but I'm going to start with something. I have double picks from three labels, if I will. So the one I want to start with now is Blue Underground. And partly because they have two stellar releases this year, right at the end of the year. What's funny is like they've usually been pretty on top of things in terms of releasing obscure Christopher Lee, Fu Manchu movies, or just like really odd stuff. And they've been really quiet like for the last year. Like I can't remember the last time we brought up Blue Underground on the show. And then out of nowhere, they drop Zombie, this like new 4K restoration of Zombie in a 3-disc set. And Maniac, which you guys just got today, and I got a couple days ago, and I popped that in. And I was just going to pop it in to kind of skim through the features. But then I cut to a scene just to see, because Elric, you saw it months ago, at a film festival, and I was like, oh, I want to check out how it looks. And I watched one scene on my TV, and I just started from the beginning. I was all right, it's going to be a Maniac night.
Both of them
night.
Look so good.
And yeah, and I think, Ryan, you said you picked up Zombie as well.
I did pick up Zombie. I haven't had a chance to crack it open yet, but I could back up the Maniac 4K.
Yeah.
It's just gorgeous.
Well, right off the bat, and I'm one of these fans that, as like most of you, that's like, oh, another release. Like, I've already bought both of these movies so many times. Why should I buy it again? Yeah, you really need to buy these again. These are the definitive versions of it. I was kind of blown away by both. Zombie looks great. I mean, it's the best it's ever looked. There's some new features on it, but basically they've carted over everything that's ever existed previously. And then the soundtrack CD's in there, which is, again, a terrific score.
I prefer when a company like them, who always had the rights, do these kind of mastery releases than the problem me and you were just discussing, which is like you've bought the Bloody Birthday from one company and then Bloody Birthday comes out from another company. And of course, extras will always be lost in that process because they're two different companies. So this is a much better way because you get to add two things you already loved. Like I've talked about it a bunch, that Maniac documentary that I'm such a big fan of by David Gregory. It's
and that was your
film.
First question about this new Maniac. I'm like, yes, it is definitely on there.
Yeah,
it's part of the bonus features. But with Zombie, I already kind of covered, but really Maniac is just like, I'm still so, I don't know, like I'm so blown away by this movie in general because on paper and as you're watching it, it's not a pleasant movie. It's definitely of its period. It could never come out like today. It could be misconstrued as very misogynist, and yet there's some, and you know, William Lustig is not exactly, I love him, but he's not exactly the most tactful of filmmakers with his approach.
Also, like, misogyny is tough though too, because if it's the character, right? The character is in that film. The character is really such a, I mean, he's going to.
I'm just, I'm making noises over here as I, but the movie is something too. Like, there's misogyny in a character, and then there's also kind of a movie that does it too. Like, the movie is kind of just as ugly as the character.
The movie's message.
Yeah, the message of the movie is just as ugly as the character.
I guess maybe I just can't see it because it feels like it's a woman revenge film to me.
I fucking love this movie.
It's a mannequin woman revenge film.
Oh, I love this movie so much, and it has so much style to it and so much aesthetic. But that said, like, if I was to get back and just dissect it as like a social message, it's not a pretty one.
Well, I think that backs it up. I think what you're talking about, Rob.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, why? But why does this one? What you just said is, but it's still one of your favorites.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Why does? What is it about? Like, I've never encountered
the poster. I think it's the erection and the knife, the poster,
which when you turn the lenticular package,
have an erection, it wouldn't be. I think that's part, or the you just see the pants and the knife and the head. It all kind of comes together. I mean, it's an amazing poster, but
I mean, the poster's great, but there is so much at work in this film visually, and then it also with the soundtrack, and then also with the acting. Like, Joe Spinelli is just captivating in this movie, and even though that it's not a pretty subject matter, and that it's got a very kind of convoluted social message, it's really captivating in what it's doing aesthetically.
Well, then, I mean, again, I think the third act, not to give anything away, but it reminds me in a sense of, you know, a decade later what they did with Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Exactly.
Which is just, there's just something about it that kind of stands out in terms of, like, there's just nothing else like it. Whereas there's a dozen movies from this time period that, I mean, this is the sort of thing that Siskel and Ebert, like, rallied against, you know, and this is the epitome of that type of movie. And yet for some reason, I don't know if it's Joe Spinell, like, even like his relationship with Carolyn Monroe is, like, once she comes into the picture, it's so charming that you feel like you're watching a completely new movie.
Yeah.
Where it's like, is this like, you know, an Italian guy trying to date the pretty photographer? I don't understand what just happened, this tonal shift. But anyway, I'm still mesmerized by it. I still think it's a fascinating movie. This has all the bonus features from previous. There's only two new things on here, and Elric, I think you're going to appreciate it when you crack yours open. One is newly discovered 16mm outtakes, and it's basically stuff that I think combat shot guy.
Buddy Giovinazzi.
It may even be him who shot it, but it's basically just Spinell walking through New York City.
Yeah.
But there's something about seeing this, and it's all cleaned up and perfect.
Oh, I was going to say, what age of New York City? Like, when did this happen?
It's
like
when they made it. Yeah, no, okay. It was like, it was basically footage. It was, he just happened to find all these, you know, 40 years later, footage that they never used in the actual movie. Mm. So it's like just extended sequences of him walking through New York City in 1980 or 79, whenever they shot it. And it's just, I don't know, there's just something charming. And there's obviously things at the beginning and end where he's not in character. And so, and you know, he does a little commentary over it, Bill Lustig. And so him saying, it's just like, it's just kind of weird to see my friend again. I've never seen this before in 40 years, and we just found it and put it on this disc. So there's something kind of intriguing about that. And then the other bonus feature, which is pretty short, is basically a 40 years then and now, which is Bill. It's edited beautifully, where they show shots of exactly the spots in New York City and what they look like today. And Bill's there. He's driving around. He drives to Jones Beach for the opening sequence. And then you cut to Bill now talking about it. It's really cool. So even that's the thing. There's not much new material on here, but it's excellent regardless.
I'll say one thing. That comparison with Henry is interesting, because these two films, which obviously got the most more heat than a lot of those, you think about what they're actually saying, and to me, it's a lot more socially positive, in the sense that these are two films that are actually show violence for what it is, which is ugly, sadistic, nothing pleasant. You don't really, you can identify, you could empathize with Spinell, but you could never like completely want to be him.
Yeah.
And I think so many of the movies, there's no characterization of the killer. It's all glorified. It's all just TNA, where especially Henry is like really a very raw look on that. So I think it's always a shame that people, especially social groups who go out to protest, always take down something because of its shocking nature. But sometimes that shocking thing is actually the best version of portraying violence for what it is, which is actually a very responsible thing to do because there's no one who's going to watch that and want to commit violence. Like, it's like I always say about Irreversible. I don't think anyone's ever probably committed rape after watching Irreversible. Like right after that, this is not a movie that's going to make you want to do something awful. So it's tough.
Look, I mean, you could tell that there's a differentiation between movies like Ximaniac and movies like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer that come where directors are coming to the table and doing exactly what you're talking about, which is giving a depiction of there's an artistry behind the character depiction and the kind of psychoanalyst of what's going on, and then those movies that are straight up going just for full exploitation and full violence and don't have anything else
the
at their core
or something. It's just like anyone
seen House That Jack Built yet?
Not yet. I'm dying.
No, this is a perfect example.
Thank you.
I'm saying we should all get to the table. Yeah. We should all come back to the table after 2018 after we've seen the film and talk about it in this light, in this context, because I've had people come to me and go, oh my God, you got to see this movie. It is absolutely atrocious. I can't believe what they do. It's bold depictions of violence. They hate women, da 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 da. And then I've had people go, this is honestly fucking brilliant.
That's what reminded me.
It's like, you know, you've seen it.
No. That's what reminded me of it is I've had the same conversations where some people have told me that it's just exploitive as shit and there's nothing pleasant in it and it's just awful and should be burned. And then other people have been like, it's so smart.
And I've had several people
tell me it's funny. I've seen woman critics say it's the best movie of the year. And then somebody else, a guy goes, oh, it's just so awful. So it's like, oh, okay, I'm curious.
American Psycho kind of falls into this vein too, I think.
But that one, it had humor to it. Yeah.
Well, I heard that Jack also has humor.
Oh, really?
Von Trier never doesn't. I always find his movies quite funny, but some people I don't think.
I don't.
Humor also is what got him in trouble in Cannes. You know,
Antichrist, man. Woo! That thing's a riot.
Like, not a Nazi. Like, the joking Nazi. Forget it.
Like, didn't work.
Anyway. But yeah, I'm excited. I'm curious about that one.
Yeah, I mean, look, Blue Underground hasn't really been active all year, and now, right here at the tail end, I think they did two of the best releases, which is Zombie and Maniac, so. If you're on the fence, these are must-owns as far as I'm concerned. So,
I'm down.
Yep.
Cool. Elric?
Me? Yeah. Wow, we've never gone this direction in my entire existence.
We always go that direction.
Yeah, we usually go left to right, man.
We always go clockwise.
Okay.
We have never not gone clockwise.
Have you? No, this is the first time we've ever done this, guys, so hang on to your hats. This could get a little backwardsy.
By the way, Elric came into the studio on fire.
I like to think of myself now as the stepfather of podcasting, where I'm going to sit here and look at Rob and go,
I thought I called you the uncle.
I don't know. Who am I here? Which
he walked in, asked questions that he should clearly already know, insulted a couple people, and then sat down and said, let's do this.
All right. Welcome back to the Movie Crypt. Here we go. All right. Have you ever wanted to see a movie that I could describe as Rob Zombie's High Tension? Does that turn anyone on here? Anyone? This is a title. No one? Ernie. Oh, okay. I got a rise out of Ernie. He actually looked up from his texting. Which is,
not really. He didn't.
About as erotic as things are going to get in here. A little movie by the director of Martyrs that I had not even heard of this year. Incident at a Ghost
Lake. We talked about it earlier this year.
Who did?
Elric. Sometimes I swear you check out. I did.
Might have been here. Really? Have you ever heard him talk about this?
Yes.
I think he's lying.
And it was referred to as just
it was called Ghostland. Yeah, it was
I could have not been here. It's possible.
No, it's possible. No, I'll double check before giving you shit.
I'd seen the.
Anyways, what did you think? Because I'm kind of reflecting on the year, and
that's why I'm doing this. Okay, so I'm doing this only because I'm fitting in all. I only am watching the new stuff right now, just because the smallest stuff. I think I've got like a 10 that's pretty locked, but Satan's Slaves totally surprised me. I would not have seen that one making my 10. It's absolutely there. So I checked this one out only because on Letterboxd, a handful of people said this was actually one of their favorites of the year. And, it definitely – he's an interesting director because, look, I truly believe Martyrs is one of the best films of that decade. But I haven't seen anything else by him since that I've been moved by in any way. And that's going to stay the case. Even though there's a lot of interesting stuff in this, it's quite confused tonally.
Yes.
And that's why I said Rob Zombie's High Tension. It's like these two – it's like, oh, you're doing the High Tension part really well. Why are you decorating everything like Rob Zombie, like with clowns and ice cream trucks? And
There is definitely a kind of veneer of 2008.
Yeah, it's got the intensity that you would expect from the director of Martyrs and High Tension, those kind of – not that he directed High Tension, but that kind of French extremist intensity, even though it's an American language – English language American film. It's got some pretty interesting stuff. So it's like the cool thing about this movie, the thing I really did dig is it opens with an H.P. Lovecraft quote, and I didn't even – for a second I thought, oh, is that for a trailer for something before the film?
Right.
And it didn't really fit with the start of the film. And then you realize it's two young girls and their mom are moving into to their aunt's house in the opening of this film. I guess the aunt has died. A creepy ice cream truck drives by them and is kind of menacing, and you don't think much of it. But the cool thing is, with the one girl is recounting her horror story she just wrote, and it turns out she's like 13 and she wants to be a horror writer, and H.P. Lovecraft is her idol. And I was like, oh, that's fun. And you know, because he was such a good guy. anyway, good idol for you to have. Anyway, but that's a small part of the story. I kind of wish it was a bigger part. And then they move into the house. When they're in the night that they're in the house, the ice cream truck comes back, and some crazy violence happens. Very, you know, very extreme, kind of over the top villain characters who do feel like they're out of, you know,
one incredibly skinny, one incredibly big,
And one's dressed like a woman, and it's an interesting, you know, an interesting setup. But so the confusing part, and when I say confused, I think the tone's a little confused. But there's also quite a high tension's probably pretty apt, because I definitely don't want to put spoilers on here, but the structure of the movie is surprising. If I say any more than that, it'll probably ruin things. But it's interesting, and we do get to see in the future where the girl's grown up and has become a writer, and it's really interesting. But there is a dream scene. The one thing about the film that I loved was the dream scene where she's actually sitting there, and a grown-up H.P. Lovecraft, a guy who they got who looks a lot like him, or is has been put in makeup, is having a conversation about her writing. And it was a really sweet, touching scene on its own. If this was like a coming-of-age movie with a totally different tone about a girl who wanted to be like H.P. Lovecraft, I bet I would have loved a movie like that.
Right.
The extreme violence. This is the thing about extreme violence.
Tough.
If you're not rooted in an emotion where I like the character, who cares? You're just watching bad things happen and people being beat up, and you're like, but I don't care about you yet. Mm. And if I don't care about you – so I failed to connect to this movie. That said, I think on a technical level, it's actually rather well made. It's not some cheapy knockoff. It feels like a lot was put into it. I think because horror fans – some people really just like extreme stuff. I think there really is an audience for this movie. I think a lot of people would actually, this would be that movie, especially fans of, you know, zombie stuff, and could be popular. But for me, it just, I felt to connect, and it definitely has a lot of back and forth as the structure goes that makes it a little complex in a way, but it was interesting. I didn't feel like it was a waste of my time. I just thought it was.
There was a point where the violence felt tiring.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like,
there's still a lot of build up to it.
Yeah, it still worked on me because I still flinched and still sat on the edge of my seat when she's trying to evade the killers. But it got to a point where I started feeling desensitized to it all, you know.
And again, that's probably because we just don't know them well enough.
Yeah.
You know, it's a strange dynamic. But it was, you know, interesting flick.
Yeah.
Won't be mentioned on my episode next week when I do my 10.
All right.
Incident in a Ghostland.
Yeah.
I have a title from Vinegar Syndrome that I bought cold while I was at Fantastic Fest.
Wow.
It is known as Alien Zone from 1978. It was released later on VHS under the title The House of the Dead. Obviously no relation to Uwe Boll's film. The film sports a handsome 2K restoration, which does look very good. It's got an interview with the director, Sharon Miller, and an interview with the screenwriter, David O'Malley, who also wrote The Boogans. Hmm. What's to say about this movie? So...
Well, you started with the special features.
It's an anthology.
No. I just wanted to set it up. I'd like to be a little bit more thorough when I cover these discs now. This was Sharon's first feature, and I think her only feature.
So, female director, from what year is that?
1978.
Yeah, when we watched it, that was the thing we were surprised. When it got up to the end, we were like, really? I've never even heard her name.
I know.
Did she do anything else?
Well, she did a lot of TV, ton of TV. She did TV before this, and then she did a ton of TV after this. So, she directed a bunch of ABC after school specials. She did a lot of Cagney and Lacey.
Ooh, nice.
And that's, you know, she pretty much stayed in the world of TV. And I think the last thing she did, I looked it up, was like some Ellen Burstyn show from 2001, 2002. Mm-hmm. The House of the Dead is quite the odd duck. It's trying to channel like the – you've seen this, Ulrich?
I saw it with Dick a few weeks back when he did the same as you. He bought it blind.
Yeah.
One of the stories I thought was really
good. Let's dig into it.
Yeah, it's an anthology.
So it's channeling a little bit of the Amicus horror anthology with like a clever wraparound story. The Amicus titles, you know, as we know, it begins with like a big setup, and then it's like, come, let's see what's through door number two, or you know, and let's find out what's going on with this patient, and then you kind of get their backstory. Here, You've got this guy who's in town on business, a plumber's convention, which is kind of funny.
That's
because,
a thing?
Was in 1978.
And you're missing he was doing some plumbing at
That's what I was getting to, is the payoff is that he is cheating on his wife with some lady who is also in town.
Which you open with,
So he's on his way back to his hotel. The cab drops him off at the wrong location. He's stuck in the rain. He's like trying to seek shelter. And what he does is he comes to a funeral home where there is a creepy mortician living there. Ivor Francis, I think is his name is.
You look at me as if I'm going to remember.
Well, you might
remember mortician's name, Elmer.
The actor. Because I remember that guy. Okay, he's a character actor. He's done a bunch of stuff. But the mortician seems friendly enough, and he gives this guy shelter, and then he insists the plumber stick around. We just call this guy the plumber. He sticks around, and the plumber's like, no, I really should get back to my hotel. And what happens is the mortician's like, no, come into my parlor. I'm gonna talk to you about these four bodies that are in these four coffins. And then he walks over to the first coffin lid. He lifts it up. And he's like, so this is a teacher. And then all of a sudden we're into story number one, where it is a deeply unpleasant and perpetually angry teacher who, when we first meet her, is wrapping up her day and she's talking about these fucking kids. There's kids like walking in front of her. She's like, get out of my way. And then she goes home. And the story is basically teacher's getting ready to make some dinner. She's angry about that. She's listening to some jazz. She's pissed off about that. She goes up and wants to take an angry bath, I guess.
Angry bath.
And while she's getting up there, she's like, someone's in my house. And I had to rewind it once just to go, what was the signal that someone might be in the house? Because there was no sound cue. I don't remember there was like any visual or sound cue, but she seemed very alarmed. And so she goes downstairs. She looks around. She goes upstairs, she looks around, and then suddenly these masked kids come out of her closet. And she's like, oh, you little bastards, pulling the creeps on me. What are you doing? One of the kids is wearing the clown mask that Rob Zombie used for his Halloween. And I'm not going to spoil it, but the kids have a little –
I think it's pretty cool.
You think it's kind of spoiler? You want me to drop it?
No, you don't need to spoil it. I'm just saying that moment after that's actually pretty – that's the best part of the whole movie is this little moment.
I will admit that this one is the best one of the bunch.
It's the only one feels like a harsh.
Well, then you got the second story is like some creep who puts his camcorder on the fireplace. Yeah,
that one gets tiring.
It gets tiring. Yeah. He invites these girls over to his house for like a first date. Who the fuck goes over his house on the first date?
Yeah.
And then he records, their murders. But it's intercut in a very jarring fashion. So he'll like set the girl up and she's like, oh my God, what is that, a camera? And then he'll jump out from behind them and kill them. But it's intercut with him doing the walk of shame through the courthouse as he's being sentenced.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, wow. So you know what's going
to
happen.
So you know what happens to him. Yeah. The third one, holy fucking shit, is this a slog? It's about a U.S. detective and an inspector from the U.K.
The U.K. guy's pretty funny. I got to say, I thought he
was. And right off the bat, you're like, the U.K. inspector, you're like, well, that looks like a Watson type. And then you realize that what they're doing is a play on Sherlock Holmes and Watson. And what if they are put to like a battle of the wits and they're supposed to outdo one another. And so they embark on an investigation and they're just like verbally sparring with one another.
And it's long too. Isn't
it's
like
so
45,
fucking
50
long,
minutes?
Man. It's so long.
But they're actually pretty good. The performances, it's not like cheap. They feel like they're actually pretty good.
Well, that's the thing. The actors are really chewing. The actors kind of know they're like, this is our movie now. And they're chewing the scenery.
It's all coming back.
And then the third one, the fourth one is some businessman, some piece of shit guy is like being mean to the bums, and he's being mean to the girl that works at the burger counter.
It's Saw.
I know.
It's kind of got a Saw.
It's got a weird thing. So what happens is he goes into a building and he gets pushed in an elevator shaft. We don't know who pushed him, and then he bumps his head, and then he finds like an exit door out of the elevator shaft, and now he's in a basement where a wall of nails starts getting pushed towards his.
Yeah, it's a total Saw.
And you're
vibe,
like, who's behind the nails? You don't know. Yeah. And then he survives the nail wall, and then he's like trapped in this basement where they just keep feeding him liquor. Mm. And so all he could do is just keep drinking. And then finally they let him out. And then I have no idea. And then he walks into daylight and he looks like a fucking wreck. He's bloody. He's dirty. He's been drinking nonstop. And he comes stumbling out. And he's like, oh, help me. And then the first businessman who's clean cut comes out and sees him. And he's like, get away from me, you bum.
Yeah.
So is the message that all bums have been through this torture dungeon? Yeah,
I don't know.
They all are pretty moral, though. They're
all moral tales. Everybody gets their comeuppance. And then we circle back around to our cheating hubby. And he gets his, and it's like, okay. And I gotta say, I mean, like, it's a very endearing production. It looks fun. It's like the best I can say about it. But oh my god, the pacing of it is just
how long
so
is it?
That's
rough. The extra running
time 80 minutes.
Oh
dear god,
this movie feels like at least 100 minutes. I had to rewind during the first the teacher incident, and I had to rewind during the final one, because I was like, wait a minute, did I miss who was doing this to this guy?
That would be cool if it all connected, like if those ones connected.
I mean,
better.
Listen, I was with the first two stories, I was on a roll, and then the detective one, the sparring detective one, just like took me completely out of
it. I feel like it's worth watching, not necessarily buying, but I think it's worth watching for that first story because I think the thing with the kids is kind of fun.
Well, they got these like weird snaggle tooths on their like.
I feel like that could have been in Tales from Halloween. Well, it kind of was. Like,
I'm always drawn to these kind of like homegrown horror movies. Yeah. I mean, this was like shot on location and like in and around Stillwater, Oklahoma. I don't know why they call it Alien Zone, to be completely frank.
There's no aliens in the film.
I mean, it does say eventually we must all pass through the Alien Zone. So maybe that means death?
Was that the original cover? Is that the original cover?
This is the original cover, the Snaggletooth Children.
Oh, that's the original.
There's a casket at the top with light beaming out from under it.
It's not even a good cover. I like the one on the other side because it's so amicus. It looks like House That Dripped Blood.
I've eaten up more time about House of the Dead than I should.
Well, I may watch it tonight.
So,
I'm almost intrigued.
The thing that is throwing me is that it's two disc. I'm looking over at your set going, wait, what's the other disc?
It's probably DVD.
It's DVD.
I was going to say, that would have been
But I do want to. But I do want to watch the interview with Sharon Miller. I'm very curious
to
hear her story. Becca.
Yeah, so I caught up on a ton of films that I think you guys have probably already discussed at length. So Cam, definitely,
like it
was one of my faves of the year. Slightly let down that nothing was really explained as much as I wanted it to be. But that said, like the whole fucking ride, I was like, I can't even like get up to go get a snack because I have to see what's going on. Like I was so into it. So absolutely loved Cam the whole time.
Nice.
Then I also watched Satan's Slaves, which I agree with Elric is definitely going to be somewhere on my top 10 list. It feels like Hereditary in a different culture, where it is just the mom dies, finding out, you know, that there may have been some type of cult involvement, and then it just kind of explodes from there. Absolutely loved it.
Yeah, Becca wrote to me one of the nights, and she said, because she's been off so long, and she was like, she said, what are you watching or something? And I said, oh, I've been catching up on all the little ones, and she's like, I don't have time. What are the good ones?
Yeah.
Because anyone that I was having, and then there was one that you just watched that I didn't get through.
Elric had recommended it for me, and it will definitely be in my top 10 list. Some of the scares in that were just epic. And then I'll get to the one that I watched last night that you said that you had turned off.
Yeah, I don't know why. I think it was late at night. Like, I like Timo's stuff that I've seen so far. This one's on Netflix. What's it called?
May the Devil Take You.
And I've been hearing Evil Dead quotes about it, and I think it was just late, and I watched like maybe the first 15, so I got kind of set up, and then I was like, I just don't know if I, you know. So if you give a glowing,
it's not glowing. I'm gonna give a mixed review of it. So I enjoyed parts of it. The setup is very similar. It's an Indonesian horror as well, and the setup is rather similar to Satan's Slaves. This father who you know right at the beginning that he was doing something shady with a cult, because he's in this old villa that like a vacation house. He invites in this like crazy witch woman. She does this crazy thing in the basement with blood and pentagrams and guts. Yeah. And then it's gory. And then all of this money starts flying out from everywhere. And she's like, and there's going to be more at home. And you're wealthy now, so go home and do it. And so what you find out is, because at the time he says, I'm doing this for my wife and daughter. And what you find out is that as soon as he gets rich, he divorces that wife, marries some really hot actress, and has a ton of kids with her. And but the one kid who he had from his original marriage, he still kept around, but she's kind of ostracized by the other kids because they grew up in kind of this lap of luxury environment with an actress mom, and she was always kind of the ugly duckling of the group. Well, Dad has died, and for some reason, before he died, he declared bankruptcy. And all of the kids, the wealthy ones and the original one, are now determined that Dad has stashed money somewhere. So they go to his vacation house to try to find whatever money Dad has stashed somewhere, because no one can figure out how on earth he went bankrupt, because they went from being super wealthy to nothing.
He's like a mogul, right? Like a real estate mogul.
He was a real estate mogul. And they can't figure out how on earth he went bankrupt, so they go to his vacation house to try to figure out what on earth was going on. And they definitely set it up that like every 7 years Dad went here and stayed for long stretches, and we don't even know what was going on there. So they go there and they start kind of examining and breaking down and searching the house, and it's all this beef going on between the siblings. And then it gets really Evil Dead-ish. And yeah, and so this had quite possibly some of the best gore and scare sequences that I've seen this year. I would say it rivals Satan's Slaves. That says it gets really repetitive.
Yeah.
Because as soon as they get to the house and it does become more supernatural, like nothing else develops. And it does that probably by about the 30-minute mark, or I'd even say 45.
And this is another one of those over 2-hour movies.
Yep.
Like 2:10 or 2:05.
It's not actually.
It's about two.
It's about two. Okay. Yeah. So about the 45-minute mark, they are at the house looking for the cash. And then it literally just kind of blatantly becomes Evil Dead, where like there's demons and you can spread the virus, and a lot of it shot like Evil Dead. The gore sequences and the scare, the like murder set pieces, are remarkable.
Cool.
But there's nothing else to it. Like the story literally advances nowhere. And then it does, it has probably, and for the first one, I was like, oh, that was great. And then by the third, I was like, please no. It had three false endings where it was like, everything's okay now and everyone's dead and here's the money and everything's cool. And then this comes out, or oh my God, you were just asleep, or we're fucking with your mind. And that got taxing.
Of horror Netflix movies.
So at the 2 hour, like the hour and 45 minute mark, I was like, if there's one more fucking false ending. And then there was another one, and I was like, you've lost me. You have lost me with The Devil May Take.
So this guy had two major Netflix movies within the last 2 months.
I like the other one, The Night Comes For Us.
I need to see that. Cause
it's pretty excellent. But you know, that's more of an action revenge sort of thing. And it's also equally as gory. And
This one, hyper gore. There's really cool stuff that they, and I mean, there's like face ripping, like literally a scene where a ghost just shows up, literally grabs her own face and rips it off. And it's great gore. Great gore setups.
I feel now I do have to finish it before the end of the year.
It gets
now
taxing.
I'm like, okay, if there's some cool gore.
I need to add that too.
Last 40 minutes is taxing, I will warn you guys, but really cool scare setups.
Okay.
Alrighty. May the devil, what's it called again?
May the devil take you.
Okay. So I have been on a hammer kick for the last couple of months, which started in October, which I know, Ryan, you're right behind me.
I got to do it.
But you know what? Warner Archive is accommodating because they just put out, these are brand new releases, Dracula AD 1972 and the Satanic Rites of Dracula.
Okay.
My problem with these is that I keep watching them all out of order. So like, I got a box set recently and I put one in, and it was in the order that it was in the set. And it was actually like, because they all kind of end with like, you know, Peter Cushing killing Christopher Lee again. And then you're like, oh, okay. And then it picks up. And so I realized like, oh shit, I'm watching it out of order. So when I first got these, I started a few minutes into the Satanic Rites and I was like, wait a minute, this comes after.
After Dracula 72.
Yes.
Right.
So I now know the correct order.
Oh, shit, man.
Wait, but let me ask you this. Does the character in Satanic Rites, has he been to the future? Or there's no logical connection?
No, these are direct. These are actually, it's a direct sequel to it.
Yeah. But does he have memory of having done this movie in that film? Like, is it referenced at all?
The event.
Having been to 1972? No. Right?
No, but what happens, but Satanic Rites is in modern times, so whatever, 73. And the thing is, no, it's a direct sequel to it because in Dracula AD 1972, in the opening sequence, which I haven't seen, I think is the end of Scars of Dracula. I think that's the one that's before it.
I remember this one better, but not.
Yeah, so it shows a battle between Van Helsing and Dracula in the very beginning, and then it cuts to 1972, and so Van Helsing's grandson grown up is now Peter Cushing again. So he's
good genes.
Better sideburns.
He's the exact way. He's like, I've been studying about this my entire life. Yeah. So like he knows who Dracula is. And that's so funny. Peter Cushing reprises the Van Helsing grandson in Satanic Rites.
That's amazing.
So anyway, these two are directly connected.
So wait, which one had the wagon, that like famous wagon wheel? That was Satanic Rites.
That's the opening of AD 72.
Okay.
So yes, that's the previous one.
Which I think is the end of Scars of Dragon. Somebody's probably screaming into.
But AD 72 has your disco.
You're all fucking wrong. You're so wrong.
Disco scene.
I missed Scars of. That's still the one that I have to find. But anyways, so back to these two. So Dracula AD 1972 is something else. Mm. And here's the thing I love about this franchise, because again, I wasn't that well-versed in Christopher Lee's Dracula until recently. I think Peter Cushing is amazing. I'll watch him read the dictionary, if anything. But what I love about this is kind of the creative audacity to always bring Christopher Lee back. I mean, it doesn't matter how dead you are and how much they change the rules. So basically in this, they're like, it's 1970s. He's like, no problem. We just need a little bit of his ashes. We'll mix it with blood.
Like
we'll get
you
a
do.
Virgin, and Christopher Lee will come back, and he does magically when they mix this concoction up and do a little satanic spell. But from there, I mean, I don't know. It's kind of fun because all the other ones were period pieces. So now this one brings it to the 70s, which is when it came out. And basically, he's obsessed with getting Van Helsing's granddaughter. It basically becomes a revenge of this bloodline now, because he's been killed several times now by freaking Van Helsing, and so now he just
called the Jaws 4 of the franchise.
The Jaws 4 of the franchise. No.
It's a blood curse,
so
which
just,
I enjoy. I mean, it says right in the front, the Count is back with an eye for London's hot pants a taste for everything. And there is a long music sequence right at the beginning after the wheel thing, where it brings us into the 70s, where one of these guys is like kind of a worshiper of Christopher Lee. He's the one that gets the ashes and brings him back. But it's a lot of fun. I mean, this is the sixth
time. I highly enjoy that one.
Such a trip.
It's just a lot of fun. And then that leads right into the Satanic Rites of Dracula. Oh, and by the way, this one looks terrific. AD 1972, beautiful, perfect transfer. And the reason I say that is because Satanic Rites of Dracula looks pretty good. It's probably the best it's ever going to look. But it's a little soft, so I don't know if that was just the general way that it was shot or whatever the case is. But it looked pretty good. This one's just freaking bonkers because it starts with like I think it's like British Satanists performing a black mass.
Yeah.
And then this dying guy escapes to let them know like, oh, they're going to bring Dracula back or whatever the case is. And they're like Satanists that ride motorcycles, but then there's snipers that like take them out. Yeah. And where's Dracula fit into all this?
Doesn't matter. That's badass.
It doesn't matter. And somehow I actually missed it. Dracula's just back. Like, I don't remember a scene where they actually resurrect him. He's just like kind of back. And not only that, but he's posing as a millionaire industrialist. And so there's one great sequence that I've definitely seen out of context, where basically Peter Cushing comes in to interview this Playboy millionaire. And Christopher Lee is sitting behind his desk with a giant lamp next to him, and the light is pointed straight at Peter Cushing, so he can't see him. He's like, oh, it's rather bright in here. And he's like, yes. And they just like they have this whole dialogue. And then finally he's like, you are Count Dracula, aren't you? And then it's like, you know, the charade is off. But it's still a lot of fun. I didn't like this one nearly as much as AD, but it's shorter. And it's just, bonkers.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't one of the subplots of either one of those about some sort of plague? Isn't there like Dracula wants to unleash some sort of plague on London or something like that? I remember reading
Definitely the plot of Nosferatu from 100 years
earlier. No. They were channeling that, but there was some sort of biochemical thing, if I recall.
I don't remember that.
I could be completely wrong.
The next one, they're all
Perfect Creature, the New Zealand vampire film.
And I could have completely missed that in my awe.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I genuinely got to get through all these.
Yeah, and this was the last one he did. Christopher Lee did another movie, but it's not connected to this, called Dracula and Son. Mm. And then another, he did a Jesse Franco Count Dracula, which has nothing to do with any of these either. But basically, I have them all. I went online and bought the very first one, Horror of Dracula, on DVD, and then discovered that one archive just put it out on Blu-ray. So I guess I'll be getting that as well. And then Scream Factory is doing the second one, Dracula, Prince of Darkness. And I think I have the ones in between. The only one that's not readily available, and I may be wrong, is Scars of Dracula. So that's the only one I'm missing. But I kind of want to go back now and watch them all in order now that I've kind of delved in.
Which one is it with Redhead Dracula again, the guy?
That is Brides of Dracula.
Yeah, that,
and that,
that
is on the Hymer set. That's
utterly
fantastic. Great, and that
is
technically considered
Dracula,
a sequel.
He's not my favorite Dracula, obviously, but he's
yeah, and that's
such
considered
a
direct
film.
Sequel to Horror of Dracula because Peter Cushing is reprising the Van Helsing from the original. Yeah, that one's great.
That, just in terms of the way that film looks, I remember going, oh, what's this shit? Like, it came on TV once, and I was like, whatever. There's no Chris Lee in this, and then I was like, wow, this might be the best of all of them.
Oh, yeah,
but
no,
it's just
great.
The way everyone looks.
Yeah, yeah.
Technically.
So these are out now from Warner Archive. Dracula AD 1972 and The Satanic Rites of Dracula.
All right. A couple of quickies. I saw the most Becca movie ever last night. So another indie. I mean, she might not like this movie, but it has literally all the box ticks of a movie that felt like somebody – it felt like, honestly, and I texted you about it. I said, it's like somebody just went to your aquatic horror lecture, took notes, and made this movie. They happen to be from Switzerland, but it's called –
I'm sure they were there.
It's called Blue, as in the color, My Mind.
Oh, yeah.
And I hadn't heard of this one, but somebody on Bloody Disgusting, might have been Miska, just wrote, like, people are sleeping on one of the best genre films of the year. It's not really horror, and I mean that in that way where it's like just, yes, it's body horror for sure. It's somewhere between Lure and Raw. It's a coming of age.
Yeah,
it's
a much
gentler Raw. Like, Raw is hard to compare. Raw is such a great debut. I think in terms of directing, to me, that's like, I'm a major voice. Watch me. Like, that's what that movie had to me. Whether you like the content or not, just like she's a director you've got to see the next film of. This is a lot gentler, a lot more, I'd say the first 70% is really just observational.
Mostly, it's teen
coming
drama.
Coming it's, of age. Yeah. Swiss film. It's a debut feature. I forgot the name of the woman who directed it. And you know, the Lure, it's, you know what I have read, there isn't a lot to it. And so even if I tell you the basic gist of what's happening, that's already the whole thing. So there's not much talking. Just comparing it to something like Lure, and that it's a body horror of a young girl. She just around the age, she's getting her period. She's trying to fit in with new friends, and her body is changing. And as she's discovering sexuality, but she also, because Becca's aquatic horror thing, the title of it was "I Dream of Dark Water."
I dream of deep water.
Deep water. So in this, there's literally sequences where the character's dreaming of water, and you're like, oh, what's the connection? And I think you'll at least find it really interesting. It's
excellent.
Like, it'll fit perfectly into the puzzle of the stuff you're looking at. I liked it, actually. I didn't walk away the way I did with Lure, which is just wildly creative. Not necessarily for me, but I was like, wow, that's amazing. And then Raw, where I was like blown away by the vision. This is somewhere a lot simpler, but it's an interesting movie. I'll be curious. It wouldn't probably be on my list next week, but it's an interesting film.
Well, it's not scary.
It's
not a horror film. Yeah. It's definitely its own thing. Lisa Brulman was the director behind it, and it's one of those like kind of character studies of a teenage girl going through body horror, you know? And I saw it at Fantasia and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was cool, but it definitely feels like it's part of some sort of weird, I don't know, ongoing theme of these movies like Raw. And I was trying to think of another one that was, I had just seen too. Well, it's like Starry Eyes goes through like a female going through a body horror,
but that pushes
experience.
The horror. Like they
no,
go
no, no,
away
no,
with
for
the
sure, yeah. for sure. But it's like, you know, it's similar in vein, this kind of Cronenbergian experience.
It's good. I'd recommend it checking out. And then the other one I just wanted to mention because this was a long, long discussed Becca, and it gets into our topic, and you're gonna love it, Rob. The guy who harasses us most on Twitter, which is Inside Number 9.
Yes,
this is The Devil of Christmas. It's only 30 minutes. I cut hats off. It's going to be one of the best things you'll watch this Christmas for the Christmas hour. It is so much fun and strange and doesn't go anywhere you expect. You're watching it. It's, you know, clunky, feels like a clunky 70s TV movie, like the British live TV ones where they had to get the actors to different parts of the set quickly and then with the cuts in between. And you're about people going to the Swiss Alps or something, and inside on their holiday, they see a painting of Krampus and they're like, oh, it's the Krampus. Uh-oh. And there's a little kid and they kind of go through the myths. So you think you're watching a Krampus story, and then as it goes, I won't, this is one that if you give away too much, it'll ruin it, but it's quickly, the one thing I will say is at a certain point, you realize you're actually listening to the director of this, kind of almost like a director's commentary. He's saying, oh, this part wasn't very good, and they flubbed that line. And so then it's getting funny on that level, but then the horror still kind of works, but it goes to a place at the very end that kind of wins you back over just as a movie. It's only 30 minutes. It was gold. And I think this is like, I was really happy to get to see it after, because I've got to say, I don't know what's stopping me from watching all of, I have yet to see
it's
anything
brilliant.
Bad. Everything I've seen has been brilliant, but this one, particularly given the topic we're heading and we're getting to our Christmas horror stuff today, this is a perfect primer. Have they done other specials like that?
They have, actually. Christmas? They've, I think that may be their big Christmas one. I don't recall another Christmas one off the top of my head, though some of them are set at Christmas. I feel like The Tales of Christine had some Christmas stuff in it. But they just did a Halloween special, which was live in the UK.
Oh, cool.
It's available on Amazon now through BritBox, and it's fucking brilliant. It's just as brilliant as The Devil of Christmas. So they've done a couple of different kind of holiday things as they've been going along. I'm in the middle of season 4 right now.
Yeah, this one was from season 3.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking for it, but this, if you're even just watch a standalone, you've never seen the show, I would definitely just watch it.
Where'd you watch it?
I mean, I think they're all on Amazon or BritBox. Right?
Yeah, if they're all on they're all available on Amazon through BritBox, and BritBox is free for a month.
Yeah,
so like, just sign up for a month and watch them all back to back. They're not all horror, but they're all like Hitchcock level of suspense. Some of them get really horror, but like one of the ones that I consider to be one that everybody should just see because it's fucking brilliant filmmaking is called A Quiet Night In, and the entire segment is silent about two burglars who break into a house and can't talk.
Yeah, that one's pure comedy, but there was one I talked about.
But it's still Hitchcock level of suspense.
No, it's brilliant, but the one I watched with Dick that you recommended,
The Harrowing.
That one I talked about in here, and that one's fucking great. That's like actually got kind of scary moments. It's a babysitter. It has a House of the Devil setup. It's a babysitter comes to the house to look after a guy who's sick and upstairs, and it just gets crazy as it goes. These aren't cheap. It's not like a cheap comedy show.
Mm-mm.
It's like everything has a lot of aesthetic. Feels like they must have had budgets of a whole movie for some of these episodes.
One of the most brilliant ones from the third season, which you need to watch. There's a couple of them from the third season and I'm just like, man, that was good. But one of them is just called The Bill, and it's four guys having dinner together. And you're kind of like, I have no idea what's going on. I'm just watching five guys talk for, you know, the first 10 minutes. And then the check comes and they start arguing over the check. And that's literally the entire episode. But where it goes and what comes out while they're arguing over the check, it's amazing. It's so smart.
Do they have anything to do with Ghost Stories?
I have no idea.
Because the guy from Inside Number 9 retweeted saying, and he tagged the people. And I wonder if the writers of the show also might have had something to do
with it. I'm going to assume it's just a small community. I know that they were – they started with Psychoville was their first main one.
Andy Nyman?
No, I don't think so. They were
he's
on
the one who's behind Ghost Stories.
Well, these guys, were League of Gentlemen. League of Gentlemen, and then they went on to do Psychoville and then Inside Number 9. And I'm so glad you're coming around, Elric, because I swear to God, I have been harping on this show since Killer POV days.
No, but I think when I first checked it out, they were on Amazon, and then they were gone.
Yeah.
And I think it went behind a paywall. That's why I didn't watch it
anymore. The first two seasons are currently on Hulu and Shudder as well. So you can see at least the first two seasons. And there are some really tight horror episodes in the second season as well. Trial of Elizabeth Gage is in, and it's about a witch trial. The whole thing is like the witch trial, and it's really smart. That's in the second season too.
But yeah, this one, no one listening to this will not enjoy this episode, that particular episode.
It's so smart.
It's right up what we love about Christmas horror. It's
cool.
And it's quite dark.
Cool.
All right.
Yeah.
I just got a couple things I'll just plow through. The Possession of Hannah Grace horror release.
The trailer made me really want to watch it.
Trailer looked great.
All right. Here's what you need to know. Shay Mitchell plays a former cop haunted by her past who is now working at a city morgue. Mm-hmm. Body rolls in. That body's name is Hannah Grace. Hannah Grace was a young woman who died during an exorcism. Spooky shit ensues.
Wait, that sounds like cadaver.
Before you know it, the corpse of Hannah Grace is crawling on the ceiling and crawling on the walls and taking out people in the morgue. Not my cup of tea. It felt a little repetitive to the murder and mayhem. And it just overall like just kind of lacked energy. If there's a film that you want to see that's about a couple of people trying to figure out what was behind a corpse's history, check out Autopsy of Jane Doe.
Yeah.
So good.
Such a good
It was
movie.
Weird. It was funny because Ciara leaned over to me about 20 minutes and she's like, didn't we just see this movie? And I was like, yeah, it's Jane Doe. Yeah, it's just that, you know, it doesn't.
Was it an indie or a big film?
Because Sony.
Hannah Grace. Okay. Yeah, Hannah Grace was big. Yeah, like there was like a 4-day stretch where they were advertising on every YouTube video, ran the trailer before it.
Yeah, not my thing, but I see a lot of people are really into it. Brian Collins. But, you know.
I'll go see it.
Yeah, check it out. Yeah. And then I got the Critters box set, which pleases me to no end because I haven't seen Critters 3 and 4, and I'll talk about that next time. But I revisited Critters 1 and 2. And all I got to say is these movies are still fun, and the critters still look great. And no wonder why Billy Zane came up the way he did, because Billy Zane is a charming motherfucker.
Yeah,
because he's in the first one playing the boyfriend, and my God, in the first like five minutes of screen time he has, he is just he's handsome and charming, and I got a Billy Zane crush. But yeah, these movies are a lot of fun. It's really fun to watch, you know, the kind of construction of 1 and 2 and who they bring back and what they do with the character arcs and all that kind of fun stuff. 2 is obviously like kicking things up a notch by, you know, showing off more critter abilities, and, you know, they're just like, and I forgot, and this is why I was so attracted to it when I was a kid. The critters themselves have a sense of humor.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. They've got
like,
weapons.
They're like they get in their ship and they take off and they blow up the house. And they're just like, and I was like, you little fuckers. It's just a fun movie. And it's obviously for a very, you know, it's for a much younger demo. I mean, like when these movies came out, 13-year-old or, God, I mean, 10, 11, 10 or 11-year-old, Ryan. I was so into it. I mean, like, I was drawing Critter. I mean, like, that was the demo. You had the character of Charlie, who was obviously the town drunk, but he was obviously channeling this kind of adolescent personality, and you loved the kind of dynamic he had with the kid, and you kind of wished you had a town drunk as your best friend. And then you see Charlie grow up in the next film, and then you've got the bounty hunters.
They're awesome. I love the bounty hunters.
Yeah, the alien bounty hunters.
No faces.
No. Those guys, no faces, and one of them turns into a Playboy model, and you're like, of course. It's just a lot of fun. And it was, you know, I had to text Mick about 15 minutes into Critters 2 because I was like, wait a minute, this whole area looks familiar. It looks like they built the town, obviously, but it also looks very familiar. And then I realized it was Elric's neighborhood of Santa Clarita.
Yeah. Oh.
And they built the town.
That's why I moved there.
Yeah.
Once I heard, where's Critters 2?
You were just like, I want a sliver.
You mean Leatherface was filmed here too? I'm in. I'm moving here. I got two movies like that on either side of me.
But yeah, man, Mick made that movie for $4 million.
Nice.
Damn. Yeah.
And that's the one with DiCaprio, right?
Yes.
No, that's
yes,
3.
Yes, it's the one with DiCaprio. Right, 2. No, 3 is the one.
3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, okay.
So I'm going to be venturing into 3 and 4 for a future episode. You've got DiCaprio.
It's at Easter. That's an Easter film, right?
The second
Critters
one.
2 is Easter.
Yeah,
Easter,
that's right.
Yeah. You get baby critters. Mm-hmm. You get Gushy Critters.
I think Critters is a fun series.
They were precocious little fuzzballs.
You get a Freddy joke in Critters 2?
Oh, the Freddy joke in it is fantastic. Yeah. That was great. I had a good time.
Pretty wonderful.
Yeah. They're great. And also, Scream Factory did a great job on cleaning them up. They look good. I mean, plowing. I'm saying a lot of plowing.
I'm doing a lot of plowing.
That word is coming to mind in this episode.
It's a snow.
I'm getting snowing Christmas. No, I'm getting through the bonus features now, and they've definitely brought a lot of people back that I was like, oh my God, they got this guy, they got that girl. It's great. So cool stuff.
I'll do a couple quick things. So Overlord, I really enjoyed that movie.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. So is that Shockwaves approved?
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay. Sure. Yeah, like that was because I'd read some not so nice reviews of it, and I was really shocked. And
it seems like horror fans all liked it.
I loved it.
It just seemed that other people didn't go.
Yeah,
from what I could tell.
I thought it had one of the best film openings I've seen in a long time. Like the first 20 minutes of it were amazing.
Yeah.
So absolutely loved where that went. Elric and I went to the opening of the new Bev, the reopening of the new
Welcome
Bev, which
back,
was really cool. They've done beautiful stuff with it, so I'm excited to see.
And they have some good Christmas horror coming up.
Well, they got Russ Meyer.
They got Russ Meyer, but they have a lot of Christmas horror.
I got questions. So nobody's talking about the renovations.
It's all like a subtle facelift.
Yeah, it's literally like it's like we redid the floor. It's still the same color, but it's all
cleaned
new.
Up.
It's very subtle stuff. They completely redid the lobby because I actually walked by when they were tearing it up. So they redid the lobby. They changed the color scheme of it. Actually, I went to catch a matinee of Batman Returns, which was wonderful there. And the host came out and did the kitty giveaway. They do giveaways for those shows, and she kind of mentioned some of it. She's like, "Look, if you look up, we redid the ceiling. There's it's basically a different kind of it's more audio friendly now. Even though the walls look exactly the same, we've put more foaming or something behind
it. Right.
And the subtle one that I didn't notice at all is apparently they did spread the seats out a tiny bit.
I actually felt the difference in my
knees were not in pain.
There's more room in the seats. They're spread out so that hopefully there's less heads in front of you if you're a little further back.
The black masking is a little different around the screen. And it was automated.
They got a slightly bigger brand new screen. And I know, it just sounded and looked fantastic.
Toilet. That's all that matters is they've got the sound system. So if you're in the bathroom, you can hear what's happening in the movie theater.
The movie keeps playing while you're peeing.
Well, the Cine Family used to do that, which I always thought was great because you could still sort of hear the movie.
Yeah, you heard the trailers. I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
But it just looks really nice. It doesn't look as flophousey. Like, I love that it looked like a grindhouse too. It looks like a step up from that right now. I got to say, the color scheme inside of the walls is the Beverly's colors.
I'm doing the Midnight Silent Night Deadly Night 2.
I probably will too.
With a bonus feature. I will be at Lewis Jackson's. And Motorpsycho. Motorpsycho. They're doing two of them as a double.
There's some good stuff. Yeah.
And I'll really quickly drop some graphic novels that I checked out. So Severed, which is by Scott Snyder and Scott Tuft. This one I really enjoyed. This is from 2013. I didn't know it was from that long ago. But it is about a 12-year-old boy in 1912 who he's an orphan, and he wants to figure out who his real dad is. All he knows is that he's a jazz musician. So he decides to take boxcars and hitchhike from Chicago to New Orleans, where he thinks his dad is. And along the way, he meets this kind of traveling salesman who's pretty much the same thing, where he's sleeping in boxcars and hitchhiking along the way, who happens to be a cannibal. And it's really tense. The last I read it as the collection, so it had all seven books, and there's only seven books of this one. The last one is really intense, where he kind of reveals who he is. This would be an amazing movie because there's so much texture and substance to the 1912 kind of boxcar hitchhiking scene. And just such amazing characters. Nothing's ever been done with it, and it didn't go past the seven books. But yeah, I highly recommend this one. This was recommended to me by a Shockwaves listener who I think brought it to me at Texas Frightmare last year. And it had been sitting on my shelf. But yeah, it was just a really, really tight read. The art's really good as well. And this one, I'm going to say, is horror light for kids, but I'm going to recommend it because parents out there, you will love this one, The Lumberjanes. This one is written by four women. It is published by Boom Comics, and it's about a group of five girls at Lumberjane Scout Summer Camp. So it's like Girl Scout Camp, and they start finding weird supernatural stuff in the woods. So they find like monsters and yetis roaming the woods that talk to them, and ghosts and shit like that. It's awesome. Marnie and I have been reading it together. We read the entire first three books, and I just ordered the fourth. This one's been going for a while now and got a lot of hype. Fox bought the film rights to it in 2015. In 2016, Emily Carmichael, who wrote Pacific Uprising and Jurassic World 3, was attached to direct it, and nothing has happened since then. But if your kids, especially like, and I'd say the elementary school level, are just starting to get into kind of spooky stuff, this is it's very Gravity Falls-ish, Erie, Indiana, goosebumpsy. But it's just wonderful stories. So cool. I highly recommend Lumberjanes as well.
Cool. And then I just wanted to wrap up a little bit on some Scream Factory stuff before I tackle the actual titles. How do I approach and say this? They've been getting a lot of flack as of late, which to an extent I understand some of it, and they have yet to really fully comment on it. They are obviously friends of the show, and they've been on. They're basically, and I was telling you guys a little bit off air before, all of the Blu-ray labels are trying to readjust their schedules and just their how they manufacture their discs, because one of the major factories in the United States that did all their print runs closed down, and so now they're kind of scrambling to still stay on top of their release schedules that they've already locked by going to outside the country. When you're dealing with the volume of what they're printing, which could be, 10, 20, 50K sort of, titles, it's just hard to stay on top of that. And sometimes outsourcing happens. So the biggest bumble was definitely the Creepshow thing.
Was that just a sound thing?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't the disc. That was more that they because of this, they had to go to another facility, I think in Mexico, whatever. And anybody that ordered it, basically, they just haphazardly put these posters in there that you paid extra money for. I'm one of them.
Yeah, same here.
And a lot of product showed up damaged. Oh, yeah. But you know, again, that's definitely an issue that needs to be addressed. But they are a small company. I know their customer service is trying to get on top of that kind of stuff, and that it was kind of just a. It was an attempt for a quick fix over a situation that nobody had any control over, and unfortunately didn't work out. But all that said, I understand legitimate concerns about that, but all of a sudden I'm just seeing a lot of hate on them for a lot of things. Hmm. One of them being price points, and price points is always a sticky, thing. I mean, their titles are really floating at the $25 to $30 mark now, as opposed to whatever, $19.99, $14.99 or whatever. And I think people, fans in particular, fans have been doing videos and stuff, and I've seen some of them, and now that I'm on the other side of it, they're wildly inaccurate about how this all works, especially Amazon, who, quite frankly, look, I buy a lot of stuff from Amazon, but they are a monopoly giant that has stronghold us, independent labels that can't really profit. I mean, look, I'll be candid with you. I'd rather you buy my Dread movies from Epic, because if you buy it on Amazon, they take like 50% of it. Hmm. And so we don't really make any money there, but you kind of have to have everything on Amazon because that's where everyone finds stuff. Hmm. So it's the
shipping's
free. It's the two, yeah, but it's not free. So basically, there's a lot going on behind the scenes. If you've been a devoted fan of their stuff all this time, I think you just cut them a little slack. It's not Jeff. It's not Cliff. They're a company called Shout Factory above them that's making decisions and trying to figure all this kind of stuff out. But you know, it's funny with the price point thing. A perfect example is people are complaining that Candyman is too expensive. It's whatever. It's $26 on Amazon, $30. Now, granted, it's pricey. We all do quality buying, but it's interesting to me that I think it's because Scream Factory is the biggest. It's interesting to me that they're getting bombarded over their price points, and yet nobody says anything about, you know, that Maniac in front of you. The list price on that is $49.99. Like, granted, you get it from $25 to $30. Arrow did Candyman, and that one's $35 as well. So why aren't people bitching about the Arrow Candyman being too expensive? It's because of the quality. I don't know if it's because it comes in a regular case or whatever the deal is, but let's all take a deep breath. And that's the thing. It's like, I've paid almost $30 for a very obscure movie from Vinegar Syndrome or Code Red, and Candyman is worth $30 as far as I'm concerned. So I just think that if you don't want it, don't buy it. But again, we're talking about Candyman. And the reason I'm bringing this all up is because the stuff I just checked out from them is Candyman. I checked out the two Urban Legend discs that they put out. Urban Legend, I always was mixed on the movie. I always thought it was like, oh, it was okay from that time period. I have a newfound appreciation for it. The disc they put out is terrific. Not only is the movie look great and a lot of fun, but disc two, it's got to be like 2 hours worth of interviews. And it's everybody. Like everybody came back for one sole reason, and now I get it. Because they all love that director, Jamie Blanks. Mm-hmm. And I love him now because Rebecca Gayheart, Alicia Witt, Robert Englund.
Wait. Gayheart's on the disc?
Yeah. Michael Rosenbaum. The reason they're all there is because Jamie called them and said, hey, we're doing an Urban Legend. Like, I'm there. So almost everybody except Jared Leto, but whatever. Literally almost everyone that's in that movie or involved in it from every facet is on that disc. Wow. And it's really fascinating. He was a Australian director, young
composer, I think.
He's not a composer. You're thinking of John Ottman. That's the one who did the second one. Jamie Blanks ended up directing this, Valentine.
Yeah, Valentine.
And then years later, he did Storm Warning. And there was one other film with
Storm Warning is really interesting.
It's really cool.
That movie, yeah.
But anyway, it's really charming to hear about him. The reason he got Urban Legend. This is why the disc is great. Is because they start showing some of his the films he made as a kid. Like horror films, and it's literally VHS stuff of him and his friends, and he's like kind of like Peter Jackson style, And then he said the reason he got Urban Legend is because he heard they were making a movie out of I Know What You Did Last Summer. And he made it. He shot a trailer in Australia and sent it to them. Yeah. The trailer is in the documentary. You will get to watch a little bit of it. And you look at it and you're like, that's awesome. And it's very close to the movie they made. They had already hired the director of I Know What You Did Last Summer. And basically they're like, who is this Australian kid? He should do this new thing we're doing, Urban Legend. And it's just, again, it's like I was just so blown away by the level of care that went into – just the retelling of that story. And I'm kind of like, I kind of want Jamie Blanks on the show now.
I would love to have him on.
Hey, yeah. You should reach out to him and see what he's up to.
Do you think he's LA based or Australia?
I think he's still in Australia. And I just read that he, another fun connection is there's a new commentary with our buddy Philippe Mora on Howling 3, which is coming out. Which is the Marsupials. Marsupials, yeah. Which is moderated by Jamie Blanks. Yeah. So I was like, oh, that's an instant commentary listen. Huh. But anyways, Urban Legend is great. I think Scream Factory is doing great. I love the Candyman release. Never looked better.
Yeah,
so much great content on there. There's all the older stuff. There's new interviews. They got Virginia Madsen's on there. Yeah. She gave I've never heard her talk about Candyman.
That's great.
Great interview with her. And Urban Legend 2, I'm going to save for next week because that is not a 2-second summary.
Okay.
But yeah, there you have it.
All right, cool. Well, we will be back after these messages. Out now from RLJ Entertainment, All the Creatures Were Stirring, from director Rebecca McKendry, who is our very own co-host on the show. We're all very, very proud of her. In the film, a young couple struggling through their first date on Christmas Eve end up in a spooky theater where they are shown several bizarre and twisted Christmas tales, all featuring scenes of holiday horror. The film stars Constance Wu, Jonathan Kite, Amanda Fuller, Jocelyn Donahue, Graham Skipper, Ashley Clements, Megan Duffy, and many more. All the Creatures Were Stirring is out now on Redbox, and it is out now on VOD, and it will be hitting Shudder on December 13th, so keep an eye out for it, everybody. And stay tuned for later in this episode. We'll have some more All the Creatures Were Stirring fun.
Tonight's Shockwaves is also brought to you by Shudder. AMC Network's Shudder is a premium streaming video service, super serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing fantastic, irreverent reviews to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes there's safety in numbers. Don't be left in the dark alone. You can stream great thrillers, horror, and suspense for $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. Shudder also has the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of thrilling and dangerous entertainment. Some people call it the Netflix of horror, but it's better than that. To try Shudder free for 30 days, go to shudder.com/podcast and use the promo code WAVES. And that's Shudder, S-H-U-D-D-E-R.
And now on Shudder is Mandy. Now on Shudder is
Satan's Sleeve.
Terrified.
Joe Bob Briggs. If you haven't seen the Joe Bob Briggs Thanksgiving special, I highly recommend
it. He played my trailer and I about passed out. I was watching it at home and all of a sudden I was like, he's fucking showing my trailer. It was amazing.
I'm going to predict now, because I know next week is our top 10 of the year. I bet at least half are on Shudder of mine already. So there you go. Shudder.
Well, welcome back. We've got some terrific guests in the house. You've just been listening to her for the last hour.
Hey!
Rebecca McKendry.
Technically a guest tonight.
Now on the other side as a co-director of All the Creatures
Elric wanted to kick her out for the first half hour.
Yeah, Elric was like, you kick him in, you're a guest now. So.
And also joining us, Morgan Peter Brown.
Thank you very much.
How are you, sir?
It's a pleasure. Thank you. I'm well.
You may recognize his voice from other Blumhouse.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Listen to Fear Initiative, everybody.
Weren't you the principal in that teenage cocktail movie?
I was a teacher that broke up a fight for a half second.
Oh, Rick, I see where you're going with that.
Yeah.
AJ was the principal in that one. Okay. That was a part that was so small, my wife thought I'd been cut out when she saw it.
but good going. Right?
Yeah. Well, there's an AJ connection. Let's
Well, you might have heard a tinge of her voice, the illustrious Jocelyn Donahue.
Oh, thanks.
Hi, Jocelyn.
Hi.
Great to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure
to be here.
Somebody
who killed AJ once upon a time in a movie.
True.
So
yes.
That's something.
Yeah.
Jocelyn, you're in the film. Morgan, you're also in the film. But you're also wearing a producer cap.
I do. Not literally, but yes.
I saw you stuff the producer cap.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Don't I took it off for that. This. I've Becca and I know each other better than pretty much anything. We're strictly family at this point.
Yeah. No, like I pretty much would give Morgan a key to you want a key to the house? You can just come over anytime.
I am Marnie's best friend.
He is Marnie's best friend. Yes. It's true. No, Morgan, I had known him as an actor for a long time. Like, he'd been in a ton of my shorts that I had done. And then when he and Joe kind of approached about what different projects we had.
His partner, Joe Wicker.
Joe Wicker, who I love dearly. It kind of blossomed from there. And then I came to know my favorite view of Morgan was the 3 hours he would spend every morning on set filling out SAG paperwork.
Yeah. So Dave McKendry, Becca's husband, every new draft just liked to add more people. And so
he likes ensemble cast.
It is an anthology. There's a large cast anyway, but for an indie film to have a 35-person cast is a lot. I've been producing now, starting with Mike Flanagan's Absentia. Oh. And I've been producing now for 8 years. Mm-hmm. And it's I love it. I will never stop doing it. But it's also like I know more about unions and LLC taxes and stuff like that than I ever thought I would. Yeah.
It's good things to know about.
If you're producing, yes.
They're fantastic things to know about.
Yeah, if you say so.
Do you just want that rattling around in your brain? Listen, sure. I just have really great Cue the Winged Serpent knowledge. obviously, this is a holiday-themed film. Becca, why Christmas?
You know, we when we started this one, it was because we had just had one of our first LAs in Christmas, or Christmas in LAs. And it was weird being out here for the first time for Christmas because we were used to the East Coast and it was cold and snowy and you would pack up everything in a good grandma's house for a couple of days. And I remember the first two Christmases that I had here in LA. One of them, I hiked Runyon Canyon by myself and then barbecued. And then another one, I went to Cantor's Deli. And it was just weird. And that was kind
of the city's half empty. Almost.
Yeah, the city, it's like a ghost town.
That's the best time.
Yeah, I know.
It's the best.
I love Christmas Day. You can get into restaurants and stuff. But yeah, and that was kind of the original inspiration was LA Christmas time. Everything's just a little weird. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of just went from there. Mm-hmm. And when Morgan and Joe kind of said that, you know, we presented them like 5 or 6 different script ideas. And then really kind of started breaking down what was feasible on budget, what could we shoot locally.
Right.
And when we decided on the Christmas anthology one, I think Dave and I came up with like 20 different concepts for segments. And then we started refining even more going, okay, well, which ones do we have locations for? Are budget friendly? Could we feasibly do effects wise? Yeah. I had one that was a pregnant woman battling off a Lovecraftian cult of nuns. That one got cut.
I forgot about that
one. I loved that one. It was my favorite.
Oh my god, I forgot about that.
So
there were so many.
Yeah, we created like 20 is probably a conservative number.
Probably.
That Dave and I created within like a week and then brought them all of them and then it's suddenly like Lovecraftian cult of nuns battling a pregnant woman with a shotgun.
Becca.
What? What?
Like
what?
Some sort of like pregnant woman fantasy for you.
Yes.
Well, I was pregnant while I was writing it.
I know, that's what I'm saying. It's like you're like, let me just throw in a tentacled monster at the very end.
It's Christmas Eve. So we wrote it for, it was a pregnant
woman.
That's
amazing. I love it.
And she had a shotgun and she was about to give birth. She was in labor, shows up at a hospital. Like, holy shit, I'm in labor. I need to get this kid out of me. And it's not a normal hospital. And it goes from there. And that was like our Christmas
Eve. She gave birth to an octopus?
No, the hospital staff is evil. They're actually
evil. Don't give it all away.
I know. We'll save this one for the sequel. So, yeah, but. So we pitched all of this crazy shit and then kind of went, well, we can afford this and we can probably find an office somewhere. And we want to make sure that we blow up the world a little bit. So let's do one outside. And then that's kind
there's,
of how.
Yeah, there's yeah. like I think a lot of indie films that have been made over the past few years, or at least you hear about this more and more. It's it was almost birthed out of impatience, waiting for other things to happen.
Yep.
And so it was literally like, what can we do? What can we do now? What can we start rolling now? Mm-hmm. How far can we get this train pushed down the track on only our own energy? And That's the more you talk to filmmakers, especially American filmmakers, that is the case. I mean, that's what happened with The Endless with Moorhead and Benson. And, you know, yeah. you talk to those guys, it's like, had a bunch of other things in the work. We got impatient. We just wanted to fucking make something.
Yeah.
And that's how this happened, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when we finally, because we literally had years of, you know, discussing it at various capacities. And at the same time, like, you guys had projects that you were waiting to get off. Yeah. And I was attached to a number of different projects that we were trying, you know, kind of waiting for. And it reached just like, fuck it, let's just do it.
Well, and the anthology made sense for Dave and Becca because, if you can tell, they're extremely prolific with the amount of ideas and things that they can crank out. And so it and as you guys know better than anyone, their frame of reference, Becca's frame of reference and depth of knowledge when it comes to the genre is as deep as anyone can get. And so it's true.
Always on brand.
Always on brand. Deep cut. Deep cut McKendry over here. Yeah. And so much so that there would be times when Joe and I would have to stop them and ask them to explain things.
Well, that was our shorthand.
What is Messiah of Evil? Okay, got it. No, exactly. I guess I need to see it. Understood. No. Okay.
Jocelyn, did you catch up? Did you keep up with any of this?
Yeah. Well, I do remember on set, there were so many inside, just so many little things that you guys knew and that no one else knew. But it was just fun because you guys, like Morgan said, you know everything that you can reference, and you did it well by, you know, telling a bunch of different stories and pulling a lot of different influences into the anthology. And it was just a lot of fun to be on set with you guys.
Aww.
Was it the first time you'd had a husband and wife director team?
Yes, and you guys are just great partners. It was very sweet to watch.
Aww, that's awesome.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the segment you're in?
I'm in an office party Christmas Secret Santa that goes wrong.
I call it a chase party. Because it's his party.
A Chase Williamson party.
It's a Williamson party.
Filmed not far from this this room that we're in.
Filmed in the Blumhouse office.
Thank you to Blumhouse.
Thank you.
So we start everyone's kind of reluctant to do this party, and it turns out that there's good reason to be because someone has rigged all of the presents, and one by one we get picked off or pick each other off. So,
yeah, and that was we wanted all of the segments to feel really different from each other. So once we kind of started locking, we went through and kind of looked at how we could visually mix them up. Mm-hmm. Like in Jocelyn's segment, I'd been watching a lot of De Palma. And so it was like split screens. Like I wanted split screens and crazy stuff moving around the screen all at the same time.
And we used a lot of the overhead like fluorescent lighting as well. And so it looks kind of like an episode of The Office.
Yeah,
sometimes.
We wanted it to look like Office, but mixed with Saw.
Yeah.
And then, like, there's other ones where we were like, okay, well, we want this one. Like, for the reindeer segment, I actually gave the cast and crew, like, a watch list. Like, because that one's more giallo, I gave them Tenebrae and Torso. Yep. And a few others Stage Fright that I had. Our DP and the actors in that segment watch. For the final one, we did a lot of Twilight Zone. Mm-hmm. I handed you guys a couple of Twilight Zone episodes to watch.
Yep.
So we just really wanted everything to feel really stylistically different for each one.
How much do you, Jocelyn, how much do you look to when you're cast? Not necessarily, this is obviously an anthology segment, so it's a little shorter, but when you're cast in a role, any role, but also obviously the horror stuff, how much do you look at movies as influences? Obviously, directors will always recommend things, but just you personally, and how much more did you get into it once you, obviously House of Devil became, you know, a hit. You couldn't have known that at the time. How much have these movies kind of shaped your almost taste and the kind of research you would do for a role?
Yeah, that's part of the fun of you know, working in the genre is looking back and seeing where things came from. And I, growing up, kind of didn't have the biggest breadth of knowledge about these things. I mean, you know, as a kid, I remember seeing Poltergeist and like that really freaked me out, and that was a touchstone. And then in high school, like Scream and Blair Witch Project and the things from the 90s that were of my generation. But then when I was doing House of the Devil, Ty is kind of the one who brought me a bunch of things to watch.
What else did he bring you?
I mean, I remember he told me to watch Don't Look Now. Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
The Changeling with George C. Scott.
So you act exactly like George.
Yes,
the whole time.
I love it.
Big influence.
He said, "Do this."
But yeah, through the years, I mean, I will just go back and watch. You know, I played twins in something recently, and I watched Sisters, and I love that De Palma film. So yeah, that's part of the fun of researching a character is seeing you know, where they come from.
Did you find it changed your taste over time? Like just the kind of things you're drawn to? Some of these likes, just, I mean, because I always think it's funny because actors essentially, unless they become producers, right, aren't initially choosing the work.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're being shaped by an outside source. But, and I'm curious, especially with horror, because I could imagine an actor who becomes famous for horror who might hate horror, mm-hmm. might be, can't even watch it, right? Because mm-hmm. some people are very sensitive. So I'm just curious if you found like basically maybe more of an appreciation just.
Yes.
And
100%. And yeah, I couldn't really, like, I was freaked out by gore and I was squeamish about that stuff as a kid. I guess I still am, but now I'm desensitized more, especially after making things where you see how it's done and you, but I feel like House of the Devil kind of was, I loved that aesthetic and, you know, all the things that he brought to me to watch, really gave me a deeper appreciation and made me a horror fan that I still continue to be.
Because and I know a little bit of that because I think we're on Twitter, we're talking about Let's Scare Jessica to Death.
Oh, yes.
And I remember thinking, when you said, I'm going to watch it, I remember going, she's not going to just love it. She's also going to want to star in the remake of it.
Man, I would love to see her remake that one.
Well, being a New Englander, that goes to my gothic romantic sensibilities.
Yeah, so, that movie, definitely has that. So, that's really cool. That's totally. But Morgan, you watch everything.
I try. I also I act in a lot of television, so I need to keep up on TV as well. But I try to watch a lot, and I mean, just talking about genre stuff, I just enjoy the risks that are able to be taken, and I always prefer if a movie or a TV show is going to try and make a point, I prefer they do it through metaphor. You know, it's all, I always find it so much more effective, you know, just going back to, I was a Star Trek geek from early on and, you know, from when I was younger than 10. But I try to watch everything. I'm not as, for instance, for today, I tried to bone up on some of my Christmas horror stuff.
You watched Christmas Evil, didn't you?
I didn't yet.
Oh, okay. Oh, Rick's disappointed.
I'm so sorry. I have a Blu-ray from the lovely people at Vinegar Syndrome at home that I need to
just
watch.
Just know John Waters loves it. That's
understood.
All you need to
know. But no, because while we were making all the creatures, I intentionally didn't watch a bunch of other Christmas horror movies. And so I was like, well, I think I can lift that embargo now and finally do it.
Yeah.
So I watched Better Watch Out and Christmas Horror Story and a little bit of Silent Night, Deadly Night because it'd been so long since I'd seen it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah.
What was the hardest one to mount? Because I mean, what's interesting to me is when I watched it, I was like, oh yeah, I like that one the most, and then that one. It was very clear to me.
Everyone does
and
that.
Yeah, and yet everyone I've read has had a totally different ranking of this, wildly different.
Yeah. Agreed.
Which is always what you do.
Good anthology.
But that's
a
good
conversation.
Sign. But ones were the technically and just the most complex and most difficult, because obviously they range from being all your actors are in a office space like the one Jocelyn's in to outside a mall to the kind of a house with aliens.
They each sort of have their own challenges.
Yeah, I'd say that each one had a challenge, but it always occurred at different times. Like with the parking lot, I think we can tell this story now.
Sure.
With the parking lot segment, we knew that we had to have a creepy van in a parking lot. And we found this van at this film rental house in Van Nuys. It's the van
Cinema
from,
Vehicle Services. It's the van from Ant-Man.
It's the van from Ant-Man. And I took one look at it and I was like, we can get the Ant-Man van. I fucking want the Ant-Man van. Get that fucker to set.
It's a star.
It's
if you
beautiful.
See the movie, this van is a star.
And, but we shot in Covina. And so then the question became
Glendora. It was still inside the zone.
Yeah, it was just inside the zone. So then, barely.
Hang on. Producer hat on. Yeah. It was inside the zone.
So well inside the zone, but we still had to have it. Somehow we had to get it from Van Nuys to Glendora.
Yep.
And so it was suddenly like, well, we can't afford to have it towed that far because the Ant-Man van don't run. Like, you have to jump that shit.
It would, in the Cinema Vehicle Services, like, we guarantee that it can drive 10 miles. You can pick when. And they were like, oh, it's about 10 miles to Glendora. And so we were like, we don't want to risk it. And the rental service was like, they charge you over $500 to tow it.
Each way. Yeah.
And so Joe and I are proud AAA members, and I used my free towing miles to get it there, nice. And Joe used his free miles to get it back.
They did not ask any questions.
That's a good indie filmmaking secret. I've never heard that one.
They
so that's a good one.
Just showed up, and we're like, this is it? And I'm like, yep. They were like, no questions. It's like, cool.
Yeah, that's good.
And so each one, that one was additionally fun because you think think that when you're shooting in LA, it's like super, you know, it's nice all the time. I mean, it's a little chilly right now, but it's 50 outside and it's still pretty, you know, not horrible. That one
overnight outside in March
dipped below freezing.
Pretty cold. It was pretty cold.
Yeah, the time it was down into the lower 30s, which was kind of weird, and especially because we had Alex Ward literally like naked, like he was wearing like a loincloth.
He was our creature actor in it, and he's incredible.
That was my favorite segment. Yeah, there's something like so elegant but creepy about like his movements of his hands.
He's everything.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so expressive.
He's done American Horror Story and he's
Grimm.
On Westworld.
Yeah,
he's one
on
of the
Westworld
giant white
now.
Guys on Westworld. Yeah. He's like a young Doug Jones. I can't sing his praises enough. He's fantastic.
Yeah, and that one has been by far one of the most polarizing segments, because if you ask me which one I like the best.
We've been talking about this off air since I saw it in Knoxville, and I can't believe that it's polarizing. Like, I'm like, wait a minute, how can that be polarizing when it's that good? It's like, it's such, if that was a short, a standalone, you'd be like, all right, cool, this is a great short. So when people,
there's a feature version.
The only way I could see it being polarizing would be if in the context of an anthology, somebody found it polarizing compared to something else. But I just, to me, it's such a, that's a really great
fully
standalone
realized,
film.
Yeah.
So The Office gets a lot of love, and that's the one that I'm kind of like, you know, I love The Office segment, but The Parking Lot for me was the like kind of Us Going Crazy style wise. Like,
it's
I had
cinematic.
Fun.
That's
I had
the big
a lot of fun shooting that one. Yeah. Like, my shot list for that was a lot more. Plus, we had a Steadicam that day.
Yeah.
It was a lot more impressive than some of the other stuff.
But talking about filming challenges, I mean, The Office segment with Jocelyn Shekinah, it was also probably our second most, or like tied for the most challenging shoot.
Yeah.
It was
because of all the personalities.
And
or?
We were, well, we by design trapped ourselves in a room.
In a room.
Yeah. With seven people?
Seven people were shooting in a room like this size and trying not to see everything, all the gack, all the lights.
Yeah.
It was, there was a lot of like, hold on, catching that flag. Hold on, boom, mic.
It's one of those filmmaking things, too, that when you know how films are made, it you start to realize those scenes where you have to get reaction shots from so many different people are actually some of the toughest things to shoot.
Yeah, like dining room table sequences take forever.
Like Karin Kusama's The Invitation.
Oh, yeah, no.
Is
it's
technically
really impressive.
A stunning movie because once you actually know, it's like, oh, my God, she had to do, like,
coverage.
Eyeline
matches
so much coverage and covering every square inch of that house. And it's
continuity.
Where the forks are and everything.
I just did a television show for ABC called The Kids Are All Right, and it's about parents that have eight boys. And I was like, my scene was like five or six pages, and we were there for a long time because we had to get so much. Just like, now get this kid, now get that kid. It was, you know, literally like a 9-10 hour day.
Did you drop a spoiler about that show?
I didn't. They have a lot of kids. Damn it. Ryan, stop getting me in trouble.
Speaking of kids, you also directed Kids. How difficult is that?
Yeah, so.
Especially when they don't do what you want.
I was terrified by
was
that
there
movie
a
in the 90s. You directed Kids?
No.
And he did
great
not do what
soundtrack.
You wanted.
What happened to Casper? What happened to Casper?
No one ever knew what happened to Casper. So on a completely side note, my mom has never stopped me from watching any movie at all. She saw Kids and immediately was like, is everyone on drugs, Becca? Are you having sex? It was the weirdest conversation ever. So in our segment with Jonathan Kite, I knew I needed a little version of Jonathan Kite. Mm-hmm. So we asked Elric if he would bring Dash.
Well, she warned me a couple years in advance, so I bred. We genetically got him.
That's right.
Her.
I was like
make sure he's brunette.
Mini Kite, work on that. And
but he didn't do the one thing he was. So I was there, and it's a little painful bringing kids to any acting because he did this before this or after he did X, Y. Karin Kusama's vignette, and
I think
he was a little
right after.
Yeah,
and both it was the same thing where the thing the person wants him to do, they just won't do it because he doesn't. So when Sundy says, you know, what was it in yours? Was it smile?
Him to look unhappy.
Look unhappy.
And
I just wanted him to
he laughed every single take.
Yeah,
and
he
thought
stop laughing.
And he couldn't stop laughing. Like
and
whatever
I
was saying was
be
hilarious.
Better.
And
I was sure it'd be more creepy. I'm like, guys, it's going to be more creepy. I bet you it'll be more creepy.
It worked.
A little kid laughing.
Yeah, it totally works.
But you really can't direct. Like it's like there's a certain age where I mean child actors when they're a little older you can, but when they're at a certain age some people it's just like you could tell them a million things it's still going to get the same thing every time. I can't remember what it was on Karin's one, but I mean he had a fake prosthetic on that took like 3 hours to put on his hand on that one.
I don't know how got him to sit still for that one.
Caillou, he's watching Caillou. but watching them in the actual thing you could see that it's a fascinating thing to like actually be a filmmaker and standing out but just be that parent guy, and I'm just sitting there sitting there watching the frustration on the DP's face and watching the frustration on the director as their wheels are turning. How are we going to get this kid to do this thing. And usually it just, you know, ends up me going, you know, I'll buy you some candy or something. And then you get a little bit of the thing you want. But it's, I can't imagine. I wouldn't want to invite that. Luckily, it was only for a couple shots. So.
Yeah.
No, and he did fine.
Yeah,
he's adorable. Honestly, yes. Yeah. So the little boy in the orange.
That's back. That's a couple years ago. It all changes.
Well, Becca, your film falls into a subgenre of horror that we all love, Christmas horror.
Yes.
I'm curious. I mean, Jocelyn, did you do your homework too?
I did.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Morgan, Peter, around, you did your homework,
did,
obviously.
Sir. Wait, yes.
What was didn't you? Wait,
Christmas horror, guys.
I never got the memo what the homework was.
So Elric has stopped reading emails, apparently, because this has come out like three times today.
I have an email intervention.
My homework on this topic. I am good on this topic.
I figured you would be.
Elric's just going to be like, Die Hard.
Yeah.
You know, I realized while I was doing my homework, and plus it was on TV a couple nights ago, technically Rambo First Blood is a Christmas movie.
All right, let's not go there. Let's not go there. It is.
Great movie.
Is it really?
It is.
When he shows up to the town, it's Christmas?
It's a plot point. As I was doing the research, it came up, and then I was like, I went to Wikipedia and started reading, and I was like, it's a Christmas movie. It technically is. Hmm. So, yeah.
The thing about Christmas horror, here's why I didn't do my homework either.
The Larry David transition.
Here's the thing about Christmas horror.
Here's the thing about Christmas horror.
And now our editorial.
Hold on, let me tell
the
you.
Larry David of horror, seriously.
No, I did not do my homework either because, let's be honest, this is a subgenre of horror that's not exactly known for its winners and gems.
Yeah. Oh,
there's
some
not
gems.
A lot of good ones.
Here's the thing.
So we have the same 10 that we pull from every year, except when there's like three new ones. So I do have one new one.
What's the new one?
I'm ready for this. And an apocalypse.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I have not
will
seen this yet.
By far be at the top of my list as one of the best.
We played a couple festivals together, and I didn't get over to see it. Yeah. I hear such amazing things.
I can't wait. The trailer looks amazing.
Came over to see.
And you know what?
Film.
The trailer kind
of simultaneous.
Sucks.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I was actually disappointed with the way they sold it because it is much better than that movie that's there.
It's on par with the Shaun of the Dead type kind of filmmaking
that's
and style.
So great.
It's really at a high level.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's like, I'm sick of zombie movies. My last favorite musical was probably Xanadu, so I'm, you know, not going to top that anytime soon. So it's all those elements that you're like, oh, I'm not going to like any of that at all. And it somehow pulls that magic trick where you're just like, this is... Not only that, the music and the song, I bought it. The songs are so good.
That's awesome.
It's actually a really, really good soundtrack. So that's like going to be one of my annual revisits now.
What's the name of really the French one that we all need to see? I'm dying to see it, but I know it's about to come back theatrical a little bit. That you got
Farm Deadly Blur. Games.
That's the one I most want to see this Christmas that
yeah.
I haven't seen that one. This is getting a lot of love just because it's the Blu-ray finally came out. It's from an older film, but Agatha's putting it out.
Blu-ray's not out yet, yeah.
It's going to play theatrically a little bit. I don't remember.
Alamo Drafthouse is doing. Yeah,
it's like Home Alone.
I watched it about a year ago, and I talked about it on the show.
Yeah,
it was made around 89.
Oh!
And it's got like five titles too, but yeah, it's like
box cover.
Yeah, it's basically killer. He's not a killer Santa. He's just a weirdo Santa that breaks into a house. This little kid who's obsessed with like Rambo First Blood has like all these like booby
Christmas
traps
movie.
And fights him. And yeah, apparently.
The thing I was struck by when like checking up on other ones is how mean so many of them
yeah.
are.
Yeah, they're pretty. Yeah,
like
well, even Gremlins. Is mean as hell just by the fact that Joe decided to put in that line about Santa. He even talks about it. I don't have kids. Fuck them.
Oh no,
like now you can never take a kid to the
seriously. Elric and I were talking about this, how we would both be like, let me
totally
show this to my kid. I would totally show this to Marnie. And then I would
then
somehow be
Cates
like,
starts talking.
During yeah. Phoebe Cates scene, I'd be like, let's go get some cookies yeah. and come back yeah. in a few
just
minutes.
Not only is yeah, he's not real, he's your dead dad.
I'm just curious from our guests. So what discovery? What was the discovery for both of you? What was the one that surprised you?
Well, I watched Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Okay.
Thinking that...
The original. Wow.
The original. But I think I was confused because I was thinking of Silent Night, Bloody Night. Is that the one that Mary Wernoff is in?
Yes.
Because I knew I was supposed to watch that back in the day. And then I watched this and I was like, oh, okay. This is like straight up, you know, it was fun.
Pretty nasty too. The opening scene's very nasty.
Yeah, that was.
But Grandpa's funny. Remember that?
Yes.
That one scene with Grandpa. I love that scene.
Hold on to Grandpa.
Yeah.
You better run, boy.
Yeah. I watched that. And I mean, of course, I rewatched Black Christmas, which is a great film. And
is is the great. It holds up so well.
It does.
And she clearly has a Margot Kidder fetish.
Yeah, and I love the drunk Margot Kidder in that. She's pretty brassy and great.
Some of the casting of the original Black Christmas like really gives it, like Andrea Martin, Margot Kidder, and even Olivia Hussey, like those could have been shrug roles, but like you put Margot Kidder in anything and you're going to get depth and you're going to get levels that you didn't even know were there.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
It's so good.
And I did rewatch Gremlins because I hadn't seen that in a while, and the bar scene was just amazing.
you're just talking about the complexity of like eyeline matches. That you watch that movie and you go, oh my God, how did Joe get all of this? Like these creatures are animatronics and they're everywhere. It's like so crazy.
You know what I love and appreciate about Gremlins is because we were talking about the New Bev earlier and they showed the trailer before my movie because it's going to show later as a matinee.
Awesome.
And the trailer, go on YouTube, he never reveals Mogwai or the gremlins in the trailer. You never see what they look like. You see Mogwai's ears, but you don't actually see a gremlin in the trailer for it. And also, when I rewatched it recently, because here's the thing, you just mentioned like that scene towards the end where there is a shit ton of gremlins and animatronics and like very complicated stuff. But the last time I rewatched the movie, what I love is like how much he hides them for as long as humanly possible.
Right.
And then what's interesting is like initially, now that I know a little bit about filmmaking, it was like, oh, they probably didn't have the money to show that, whatever. Creative choice, totally. Like I think the first time you see a gremlin is like an hour into the movie when he just pops out of a draw really quick and then closes it. And they're like, oh shit, what was that? I think it's interesting how much restraint was shown in that movie, not only in the actual movie, but even the marketing where the trailer, I was like, oh, wow, yeah, you don't see them at all.
Make us care first. That's what we were just talking about before.
And then microwave them.
Yeah, exactly.
that epic battle with the mom in the house is pretty incredible.
Oh,
and it is a heartwarming movie, too, besides the Phoebe Cates backstory.
Oh, yeah. Mogwai in the little pink Barbie car is so cool. Yes. I love that.
Yes.
It's so fun, yeah.
And Corey Feldman.
The one scene that I always love is before the microwave, and the mom sneaks into the kitchen. He's munching on a gingerbread cookie.
Yeah.
And then he thinks he hears something, and this big ear comes up, and I've always loved it. I always wanted to cuddle that gremlin because I love his big ears. But it was so much emotion in their own faces that they were able to get through. You know, I mean, like you show the bar scene is a great demonstration of that. The theater sequence, you see one gremlin wearing the popcorn bags on his ears. That I know that gremlin is a maniac.
It's like he's the life of the party. Yeah, that guy,
you know, it's just really fun.
I think that's also what made it so accessible to kids. Kids like me at the time was Gizmo's expressions.
Yeah, sure.
Because, you know, he just had these beautiful puppy eyes that would grow and expand and giggle and smile, and it was just so much. And even I had like the little talking gizmo that looked like a Teddy Ruxpin, but the little mouth moved, and that thing was fucking adorable.
Yeah, so, it's magical. Yeah.
I think we all wanted Billy's attic bedroom.
Yeah, oh my God. Why wouldn't my parents finish the attic?
I always wanted that.
I feel like you could do an entire episode of like bedrooms from movies that you wish were yours.
I think that's a great topic because I grew up in a two-bedroom apartment and I coveted any place that had like a remotely like a teenage boy's bedroom. Like the kid. All right. So there was another life before and I had a house that I had moved from one location to another, and I was getting ready to move inside it. And they were like, okay, what do you want your office to look like? And I said, the Salem's Lot bedroom.
Yes.
I want the kid from Salem's Lot. I want the same color. So I had them look at the color red that was on the walls, and I said, I want the ceiling black, and I want that color. And they did it.
Salem's Lot just came back to Shudder, didn't it? I think it just went up. I need to rewatch. See, it's been so long.
I compare my childhood home to Grandpa's home in The Lost Boys, where every morning you would wake up and there's some new like taxidermy thing. Like
taxidermied on
the wall. Dad went hunting last night. We have a squirrel. It's looking at me. Yeah, and you still go. It's now been reduced down to fish because my dad has focused his later years on just fishing. But
and
you walk into
movies,
the kitchen,
and then there would be movies that would go too far in setting your expectations. Like was it Gleaming the Cube, where he literally lived in a hole in his front yard?
I think so.
Like, I just want to go out into my front yard, open a hatch, and go down into my bedroom.
That movie's awesome, by the way.
Well, I remember Dad would totally be cool with that, right?
I remember after seeing Gleaming the Cube, I immediately raced home and I dusted off the skateboard and I started taking it apart. My parents were like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, gotta grease the wheels and
shred the knob.
And I was like,
I'm gonna
like,
go outside and you're skate just, under semi trucks.
You're just breaking it, was what you're doing.
Anyway, Christmas horror. Christmas horror.
You know what I'm gonna add to the list is rare exports.
So
I
good.
Love rare exports.
That's so fun.
Rare exports. Oscilloscope released it a couple years ago. And it's just got so much. It's got a sense of adventure, a sense of awe, a sense of mystery.
Yeah.
A lot of naked old guys.
Yeah, boy.
And then, and then a very Krampus-like creature that you know they promise. And
it does it's mythology so well. Like that's like there's some movies that play. I really enjoyed A Christmas Horror Story. I think it's like, you know, but it's bonkers. It's totally nuts. It's like this Santa kicks ass, and he's like, and he's got a bloody staff, and it's just sort of like, okay, sure. it's that rare exports kind of like sets up all these kind of fun things to play with.
Yeah. Well, I think it's like that. It's got a Goonies-esque vibe.
Yes.
You know, once you've got the kid riding on a package that's hoisted up by a helicopter, and the kid is like hundreds of feet in the air, and he's all by himself riding on a rope, and he's like, yee-haw, and you're like, yeah, I get you, kid.
Yeah.
I get that. I understand.
We're
that.
Okay because
that.
He's okay.
Yeah, I know.
Yes. The movie is telling you he's going to be fine.
Wait a minute. What's this? Wait a minute. Christmas Horror Story?
That's the one that came out. It's Canadian. Yeah, it was like Copper Heart Productions. David Hayter was the
David Hayter was an EP on it.
And it's got a Krampus tale in it, but it was an anthology. It was put out by RLJ as well.
It's very Canadian. I will say that.
I saw it when it came out initially. Refresh my memory. I know it's an anthology.
It is, but they're interspersed. So it's not one story, another story, another story.
Yes. And I think that's why I didn't like it, is because I just wish they stuck to each story.
I had the same thought.
That was my initial reaction. Like, there's so much cool stuff here, but they keep cutting between the stories trying to do that Pulp Fiction thing,
right?
And it just doesn't work.
Yeah, it works. I would much sometimes rather see them and other times. Yeah, exactly. It's that kind of thing where anthologies by their design are a little repetitive, and so in fact in All the Creatures we did an intense wraparound that helps you move through it, because we didn't want you to sit back in your seat and go like, all right, that one's done, on to the next, and you know, it's like we're trying to avoid that, and other movies have tried to avoid that too, and Christmas Horror Story definitely by intercutting them all a bit more, and it works in some spots, and then in other times it just feels jarring or anticlimactic.
Well, in that case, and I don't want to bag on these films, but it just feels like that was more of an afterthought and not something that was structurally from the get-go.
You could see them maybe playing around.
Yeah, like, oh, maybe if we recut it, it'll have a different pacing or whatever. Whereas, like, if they plant, like, you know, like, Trick or Treat, plan.
It was clearly part of the design.
Very, yes. Yeah, and that was very tightly scripted. William Shatner plays a drunk radio DJ on Christmas in Christmas Horror Story. And it's worth watching for that, actually.
Yeah, it's really worth it for that alone.
So
I have some, you don't remember, but it's on on Christmas Horror Deep Cuts that I will do. Of course I do. So I'm going to start with, and this one is a fucking deep cut because it hasn't been released in the States. Alex Diaglogasius's, and that was a lot of syllables, Day of the Beast. It's happening on Christmas, like they're building up, or it might be just the Christmas season. It's either Christmas Eve or New Year's Eve, one of them that they're like building up to. But I fucking love that movie, and it's criminal that it has not been released in the U.S.
How old is it?
Like 96, 97. Oh, wow.
95, 96,
They had a pretty, like when I grew up, that was like a normal release. I didn't remember seeing it.
I remember the VHS, but even the VHS got pretty buried. Uh-huh. And it's so good. So for those of you guys who have never heard of Day of the Beast, it's worth owning a VHS player just for this one or getting an international. It is about a priest who is doing all of these absolutely horrible acts at the beginning, just kicking people, punching them on the street, knocks over a church, sets the cross on fire. And what you find out is that he is trying to commit as many sins as possible because he knows that the Antichrist is going to be born at the stroke of midnight on, it's either Christmas Eve or New Year's Eve. And he wants to get as close as possible to it, and he has to commit as many sins as he can to get close to it.
Okay.
And so,
but funny.
But yeah, it's hilarious. It's hilarious.
Right. Sounds like it could be.
But then he needs help because there's also like magic incantations and a lot of satanic stuff that he has to do. He's trying to literally bring the Antichrist about himself so that he can take care of it, like kill it. And so he knows nothing about satanic
deep
cults.
Cover priest.
Yeah.
He knows nothing about satanic cults, so he enlists the help of a metalhead who listens to death metal music, and then a street musician who literally knows nothing about magic, except for like sleight of hand stuff.
This does sound like a Becca movie.
And the three of them get together to try to destroy the Antichrist, and it's wonderful. So I highly recommend hunting this one down. Yeah, it's a total Becca
film. Probably is Christmas because if it's the birth of it's the birth of the Antichrist.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure it is Christmas. But yeah, it's definitely like Christmas Eve. The Children.
Came out again from Vinegar Syndrome.
No, that's the different Children.
This is the Children from the 2000s.
Oh, yeah, like 2000s New Year's Eve.
No, because they've got a Christmas tree up.
It is a Christmas one. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a couple of families. And this was released under, I can't remember the label. It was like one of those Sam Raimi's Ghost House. It's a British film. It is about a group of families who all have kids, and they go to this remote cabin in the snow to celebrate Christmas together. And like within a couple of minutes of being there, one of the kids gets sick and they're like, oh, the kid has a cold. And within the next couple of days, it seems to work its way through the other kids there. But it kind of starts changing them. Like they start having mental problems and they start getting these really high fevers. And then they get fucking ravenous. Ooh. And there's no place to go. And they're in this snowy cabin at Christmas time. And the biggest thing is that they start killing adults. So it becomes kind of like, I can't remember the name of the Italian film.
Who can kill a child?
But on Christmas time. And yeah. I remember loving it.
If you want to not have kids ever, this is the movie. Is it
too late for me to wish not?
Yes.
Awkward position.
Yes, it is.
There's a lot of stuff that gets under your skin in this movie. And there's one particular child that you... This is the dangerous thing about the film is that you want to see these kids dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I remember watching it. I saw it at AFM, and I was like, "There's one kid that's just screaming nonstop, and all you want is nothing more for that kid."
It's like the first. It's like the first 30-40 minutes of the Babadook.
Yeah. I was gonna say it's the Babadook. Yeah. Imagine like five of the Babadook kids.
But I think that's not people without kids. See, when I watched the Babadook, I understood it as well, and I also felt a little bad for the kid. But I have heard that from so many people. They're just like, oh, he's so annoying. God, I'm like, no,
you should have a kid. Really, he's just like five. Yeah. That's all it is. He's just five.
But yeah.
Well, what's good about the Children is it runs the gamut of all the emotions that you would go through and all the scenarios. So, you know, for those who are like, just kick the kid. Well, yeah, they do that. And then it's like, well, why would you kill that kid? Or, what, you know, you would go through the kind of
Trying to rationalize the parental
stuff, you know. It's like, I don't want to do what I have to do. And, you know, there's some really cool stuff. And then there's like the point of view of the teenager who's going through something herself. It's cool. I really wish Tom Shankland, who is the director, did more stuff. I think he just kind of went into TV and, you know, other, I think, British dramas and stuff like that.
Yeah. But there's a really cool set piece in a tent where one of the adults is approaching, or it might be the other way around. I just remember that there's a really tight set piece where somebody's in the tent and somebody else is approaching it, and you're seeing it all kind of in shadow and silhouette, and it was just a really tight sequence. Yeah. So I will also say Lin Shaye in Dead End.
Yeah, that's a fun movie. That's Ray Wise as well. Mm-hmm. And that was a nice surprise. It's like they were on a Christmas holiday trip to hell, and they're on the freeway or the back road the whole way. And
they get off the freeway to take a side route.
Yeah, that's a fun movie.
Yeah, I like that one.
And that really is Christmas themed. Mm-hmm. It's not just a backdrop. It's meant to be at Christmas. Yeah. It's about Christmas travel, yeah.
Yeah, and that one I really love. And then also P2, which I find to be so fun. So I had to put
it in. I back you on P2. I think that movie is fantastic. It's got some great Wes Bentley. and it's also – there's a great scene in it. I used it for
Aja? Did Aja direct that or just produce it? Or
he produced it.
Great Kung Fu
director.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's right.
But there's a great scene where – shit, who's the lead?
Rachel Nichols.
Rachel Nichols.
Yeah. Oh, not Rachel Nichols.
She comes out. She comes out of her fugue state, and it's just like a blurry image of Wes Bentley dressed like Santa Claus, and he's like, "Ho ho ho!" And I was like, "This is classic Bentley." it's really, really fun, and just kind of relentless.
I kind of like that movie. It feels to me like because it was Alex Aja and them making their first American movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It feels like a really bad American remake of an awesome French film, but they just skipped the French film. Yeah. And they're like, "Let's just go right to our terrible American remake."
I will say speaking of French film, Inside's technically a Christmas movie as well. That's Christmas Eve.
Which actually, that'd be good to watch at this context. I hadn't thought about that.
It's like a great children-themed recommendation.
So you watch Inside and then the children.
Sure.
Back to back.
Does anyone else, because there's so many other horror movies that aren't technically Christmas movies, but like set in snow, that kind of feel like Christmas because they're set in snow, like Dead Snow, or even like Troll Hunter, which, you know, isn't, you know, it's because it's set in Norway and it just kind of feels like it.
I think that's year round there, so.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good point. Did anyone ever see, I never saw it, Saint or Sint.
Sint. I was just looking at a photo and I thought I didn't see that one either.
I'm a big fan of Sint.
I've heard very good things.
It's really, really cool. And I think it's from our director friend who did Amsterdam.
Who did the lift in Amsterdam.
Oh, Dick Moss. Okay.
It's a variation on the Santa Claus myth. And then he's got like minions.
I think it literally came out the same year as Rare Exports. Yeah. And so it got buried a little.
Exactly. Yeah. And because Rare Exports got a little bit more noise. Always out of it, and Sint, because Sint is a little bit darker and a little bit grimmer, but I think it's a little more deliciously evil than Rare Exports, but it becomes a city-wide thing where you literally have cops in the streets of Amsterdam chasing this horseback riding Santa Claus gone bad.
I have seen it. It's fun. All his stuff has that. It's kind of big. His stuff always feels big scale.
I'm a big fan of Amsterdammed.
Amazing kill sequences.
If you only have 7 minutes this holiday season and you want to watch a feature but don't want to watch more than 7 minutes, I'm going to pick Santa's Sleigh because I think the first 7 minutes that is one of my favorite of any horror film, let alone anthology. It's got Fran Drescher, James Caan, have this giant, it's a big dinner table, they're having Christmas dinner, Bill Goldberg, the Santa, comes down and massacres all of them, but it's orchestrated in the most comic, like brilliant way. The director's a really nice guy, I met him years ago. I love it. The rest of the movie becomes a lot more generic, though there is a crazy
stop
motion.
Does Bill Goldberg jackhammer anybody?
No, he's in character the whole time, but in the middle of the film, they do a stop motion sequence just like out of Rankin Bass, and you're watching this movie that's kind of, you know, silly, and suddenly it cuts to the sequence and you're
silly.
Like,
I don't know what you mean.
But I'm not kidding. The way it's filmed, the first few minutes, trust me on that. After that, you might not need to watch the rest. But Fran Drescher dying, you just have never felt better when she's talking. You're just like, no, get her. But James Caan, isn't it? That's one. The couple, I mean, look, I'll always share one of my favorite Christmas movies, Christmas Evil. I think it's a terrific movie, just going blind. It's not a... For horror, it's not that horror. It's much more of a bleak character study, but it's a really cool movie. And has one of the best.
Yeah, you guys know my taste.
It's one of the best endings to any horror-like movie. It's just such a kind of fun, surprising last moment. That one, and then my other outside the box that I've really come to like want to recommend to people is the last of the Silent Night, Deadly Night films. I think 5 is the best of them.
I
think
Toymaker. I honestly stopped at 2.
I think 4 is really bad.
I enjoy 4. It's Brian Yuzna, who I love. I love Witches and Yuzna.
I don't think it's a Christmas movie. I think they just decided to call it a Silent Night movie.
It was like Die Hard 4, where it was not a John McClane movie, and they just made it one.
But number 4 is the guy who wrote...
yes, unfortunately.
You probably remember Martin Kitrosser, who wrote a couple of the Friday 13ths. I think it was like 3 and 4.
Okay.
He's Tarantino's... I think it's AD for every one of his features. So he's had a bigger career post giving up directing, I think, working with Quentin Tarantino. But he's just one of these guys. Every year I watch one of these movies, and I think they're really uneven and wildly bad at times, that series, you know. And then I got to the last one thinking, oh, this is going to be the worst. And who's the actor in it? The classic, the names, he's like one of those classic. Can you pull that one up?
Which one? He wrote Friday 3.
Friday 3. But part 5, I'm just totally forgetting a classic American actor.
Oh, what's his name? Why is he not in the
Toymaker is... He'll find it.
I
can't believe it's just, he's like...
let's all just Mickey sit on
Rooney. Mickey Rooney is the Toymaker, but it's also the guy that did the effects for Society and Reanimator.
Oh, boy.
Does the effects. So the toy effects, these toys that come to life and like kill people are so... Screaming Mad George.
Wow.
They're incredible. So it's just a movie that it's much better than it should be. And I think it's the most Christmassy out of all of them. I mean, number one's a slasher. This is not a slasher. I like this movie. I will stand by this one. I don't know how hard it is. It's in a box set with like 3, 4, and 5. We're on a disc
DVD
with 3, 4, and 5.
With, 3, 4, and 5. That's right. On DVD.
It's fun.
It's talking about that, how he was directing all of these like interesting, crazy movies, and now he's just ADing or something like that. Jocelyn, have you ever had that experience that I've had a few times where you're working with a director and then you like look back at their filmography and you're like, holy shit. Like I did Modern Family earlier this year and it was directed by a guy who AD'd most of the Coen Brothers stuff in the 80s and 90s. Yeah. And I just took him aside and I'm like, you AD'd Fargo and Miller's Crossing. Cool. And he's like, yes, I did. And I'm like, can we just talk for like 2 more hours?
Yeah, I mean, usually you have that experience like with the camera guys, you know, like you'll be working with a cinematographer on something that has shot something incredible, even if it's like commercial work. That's happened to me a lot. And, you know,
a lot of people do commercial work. Yeah.
Well, recently we had yesterday, and this isn't spoiling anything and it's not revealing anything about the company, but we met with Jack Bender from Mr. Mercedes.
Oh, sure.
And on my way out, I was like, so, Jack, we really do need to talk about Child's Play 3. And he goes, oh, man, your generation. And I was like, oh, yeah. I was like, please, let's talk about this. He's like, you like Child's Play? I was like, I love Child's Play. He's like, all right, we'll talk about it sometime. Just call me.
That's great.
New generation of kids.
Yeah.
I can go on about Black Christmas. I can write books on Black Christmas.
Seriously.
I absolutely adore Black Christmas. I flip-flop year to year on Black Xmas.
I still have never seen
Sometimes I love it in the way that I love other bad movies. And sometimes I realize that I'm committing to pure pain. And I don't.
Who's the big champion? Is that Collins? Somebody was a big champion and then
like
I rewatched
Collins
it.
Collins,
I thought it was okay. I thought it was kind of like, it's Glenn Morgan, right?
Yeah, I think out of context, it's a really batshit insane movie that if it wasn't any association of Black Christmas.
It's actually got a really good cast.
Well, that's the thing. You look at the
Michelle Trachtenberg and
Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Katie Cassidy.
Yeah.
On and on and on. You're like, and they're all doing a great job of it.
Yeah.
It's just there's something.
But they all look identical because they have the same hair. Like, so it's like, oh, they were in that? Oh, because they all look the same. I can't differentiate.
Probably a Bob Weinstein note.
Yeah. I haven't seen it, so how much of a departure is it? Or what?
It's what they do is they take Agnes and Billy and flesh that out a little bit. You get a little bit of Billy's backstory and why he is the way he is.
Right.
And, he's jaundiced and there's all this stuff and he lives in the walls.
Yeah,
and crawls
around. That was the cool
things you didn't need
angle.
To know.
Yeah,
yeah.
At all.
It's like it's like a ton of Michael Myers backstory. It's like you don't really need it.
I never watched it again, but the first time I watched it, I saw it in the theater and I was like, this is cool. I'm eating popcorn.
There's polish to it and there's a certain sleaziness to it and there's I got to remember there's
it's,
like a sex
as your official video store person. I don't think it's Jocelyn from personally. I think I don't either. Jessica's much more your bag.
To me, it's like two excited 15-year-olds that love Black Christmas, the original, going back and forth about, like, oh, you know what would be cool about Billy? What if he was like yellow?
Yeah. what if the gingerbread cookies were made of skin, bro?
Yeah. I remember hearing that and going, what?
So it's the pro version.
Ideas that you're like, who the hell?
And then they were like, but wait a second. So the like we need emotional. We need emotional complexity. Sex tape. What if there's a sex tape out there, bro? What if that gets out and nobody likes each other?
I've never seen him do it, bro. I kind of like that.
I kind of like Ryan's pro impression.
Well, Andrea Martin's in it,
new
too.
Podcast. Right.
Oh, is she?
She plays one of the house mothers.
I love what the original Black Christmas pulls off in the terms of the mystery, because even though they show you from the very beginning that there's a killer in the attic and he's still up there, it still makes you question, wait, is it the boyfriend? I don't know. Like, it feels like it could be. And then it just kind of leaves you.
Yeah, there's no answers at the end.
Yeah.
But that's what's cool, that it's like a nameless, faceless terror. You know,
It does that thing that a lot of 70s films were able to pull off, that as whether you want to say it was studios got more involved or things had more sheen into the 80s and 90s, it got lost a little bit. But Black Christmas feels like an unsafe movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is.
Oh, you are in the hands, even though it's Bob Clark, you are in the hands of a madman. Like, and that's, I mean, we talk about the phone calls.
Yeah,
so much.
We tried to replicate that in the phone call. That was our wink at Black Christmas, where we had the voice actor doing
just
it, listen to it.
Pushed and pushed
and
pushed.
And we were like, we want you to just feel completely unhinged. Like, we don't want it to be a composed killer. And that's what the Black Christmas, I mean, that's literally
it's
the whole movie.
To this
movie.
Day, like, shocking that the phone call on the original. Mm-hmm.
original. Mm-hmm. Like, it's 1974, and you hear it now, and you're like, whoa! Like, it's just, like, immediately, like, wow, this movie's pushing a boundary.
Yeah, is he masturbating or killing someone? Yeah. Like, I don't know what he's doing, but it's just unhinged.
It's because you don't get to see. And right. If you did, you would get, what's the Pat Healy film where he's on the phone?
Oh, Compliance.
Compliance. Yeah. Compliance, which I think he's fantastic. So but I do think that's an example of if we didn't see him at the end, like, because they show him, I feel like if you didn't, I think that would be 10,000 times scarier, because it's just like, who was that? Yeah. Who is controlling me just from a voice, and how we apply to, it's like those psychological experiments they used to do.
But
but it's just enough to give you to know who it is.
Right.
It's a choice. It's a directorial choice.
I'm trying to dare myself to watch Compliance again. I know. I think I was watching it by myself.
If you ever want to, and
also a Christmas movie. No, I have no idea.
just blind recommend somebody Compliance. It's like, you want to watch a weird movie?
Well, that's what I do. I blind recommend Compliance to those who are daring and antiviral.
Dogtooth.
It's incredible.
Dogtooth gave me anxiety attacks where I was just like, I can't be around these people. Yeah. Like, I am just, everything's so fucking out of control.
I don't know if I've ever been made more uncomfortable by a movie.
Elves. Who's seen Elves?
So I wrote Elves down on my
list.
Rob,
you've never seen Elves?
No.
So Elves is one of my yearly watches.
Elves this year, me and you.
Sure, let's do it. So
Elves,
y'all can come over. I got the VHS copy.
Of course.
It's wonderful.
Is that all it's on, a VHS?
Yeah. I don't think it's made it past that. It's Elves. So Elves is quite possibly one of the most bonkers movies ever. And I can't believe that you have not seen this.
I've seen the clip where they open the presents and someone explodes. That's all I've seen from
So me. The concept of Elves is that a group of Nazis decide that they want to take over the world. And so in order to do this, they genetically engineer little mutant elves, which they're going to send out on Christmas. And the elves' mission is that they have to rape and impregnate virgins. They have to be virgins.
Yikes.
And they're little elves with very plasticky heads. Yeah. And the only person who can stop them is the chain smoking. And I cannot underestimate the chain smoking angle of this. It's like an anti-smoking commercial. Yeah. Dan Haggerty, who is lumbering, and you are literally waiting for the guy to go into cardiac arrest the entire movie. You're just like, he's going to have a stroke in this scene. He has to.
It sounds really similar to the first book that's mentioned in Paperbacks from Hell.
What's that
movie's called? The Little People, right?
The Little People, yeah.
I've never read the book, but he describes. It sounds like a very similar pitch.
I don't know if this was based on a book.
They might have gripped from it a little
bit. This is Michael Mann's first film, right? We're talking about?
They're almost very...
The Keep Elves.
Elves, this is one that you watch with friends. I mean, like, I sit down and watch it by myself because I find it so amusing.
So
but
sad.
I know it is. Thanks, guys.
We'll come watch it with you, right, Ralph?
Thanks, guys.
Sure.
It is batshit. I mean, like, it is just insanity. And parts of it are, like, really, like, Dan Haggerty's life in this is, he's playing, like, a mall Santa, but he's chain smoking and drinking and just has a miserable existence and then has to save Christmas from Nazi elves.
Yeah.
And it's
the things like they put this kid
now you've sold
through,
me, guys.
The kid, little boy in
the
it.
Little
they put
boy.
The boy. Little boy. I mean, I almost feel like it's borderline child abuse. The things that they make this little boy say. I'm trying to pull up my Instagram because I got all of the best, all the highlights on my Instagram feed somewhere. I'm going to try to pull it up. But, I mean,
feel
like I
feel like I remember seeing the videos you were posting from it.
So the movie's from 1989, and it had an amazing VHS box cover, which is why I rented it the first time. And then for some reason, I was like, yeah, this is like my holiday tradition now. It's not good on most levels. Okay. But that said, it's just sheer...
See it with a friend.
See it with a friend. It's sheer batshittery that you're just going to be like, holy shit. And the elves are the most... I don't even know if they're like puppets or if they're like men in monster suits, but they're plasticky and they don't have any expression except to open their mouths. And so that's all they do is like, I'm coming at you and his mouth will open. I'm trying to scare you and his mouth will open a little bit. It's crazy.
This is stocking that keeps getting stuffed.
Yeah. You know, it's like Elric's already
what
sold.
What is the, Rob, I think you have this on Blu-ray. And another one I'd like to see this year I've never seen is the David Hess directed. Is that
To All a Good Night.
How is that actually watchable or is it not?
It's kind of ugly.
Jocelyn wouldn't like it.
not a Jocelyn film. Not Jocelyn approved. We're trying Jocelyn to protect you from the really ugly stuff. You know?
My memory is we will enjoy it as a batshit exercise and like, wow.
Is there much Christmas to it?
Oh, God, what am I – you know what I remember about it is there's – and it's I mean, this is kind of spoilery stuff. So if you don't want to know about David Hess's obscure Christmas movie, skip ahead by
14 seconds.
Yeah.
No, it was like 79. It's right before Friday the 13th.
Sure.
And it's got a lot of similarities to that. The problem is he shoots a lot of Day for Night and they never fix it.
I remember you saying that now.
So there's tons of scenes at night that are in actual day.
Whoops.
And they're talking about how dark it is and stuff. You're like, what am I watching? Like, did I drop a tab or something? Like, forget. But yeah, it's been a couple of years. My memory is it needs to be seen to be believed.
Okay. Then I'm watching that in the other one, Home Alone one.
Home Alone one, yeah. Deadly Games, I have a Blu-ray. I have a foreign Blu-ray of it. Let me throw a couple of quick things at you. Just to spice things up here. I don't know if it's a Christmas movie per se, but it came up on a search I just did. There's a movie.
Wait a minute. I'm not trusting your research here.
got the Google here to help me. But no, there's an obscure movie called Wind Chill with Emily Blunt, which I know.
It's good.
With Emily Blunt. Oh, cool.
I watched
Parker
it when it came out.
Gave that to me.
Yeah, I have a vague memory of reading about it in Fangoria. I was taking the train into New York City, and I was reading a whole giant article about it because it's basically, I think, doesn't she take an ad to do a carpooling thing? Yes.
Yep, she's going home from college for Christmas.
Wait, I think I've seen this.
It's good.
And it's
good.
Pretty good.
I think we all went to go see it opening night. Because we gathered up a big crowd.
This is what happened.
But it's on Blu-ray. Believe it or not, it's on Blu-ray now, but it's part of a – it's like one of these Mill Creek cheap like triple features. So it's Wind Chill, Closure with Julianne Moore, and Perfect Stranger with Halle Berry. But it's $7.50 on Blu-ray.
All right,
that's
$2.50 a movie.
Yeah, I picked it up to have Wind Chill on Blu-ray and get two extra movies.
There was a really tight setup, and I remember it had a really good plot twist at like the top of the third act that I was like, "Well, I definitely didn't fucking see that coming." But like, it gets really Hitchcockian in the second act as well. Like, it's got a really good setup.
Yeah, so I'm going to revisit that one, and you can too for really cheap. And then to follow Becca's theme of movies that take place on Christmas that you didn't know take place. Genre adjacent, but my favorite Dolph Lundgren, Brian Benben movie, I Come in Peace.
Takes place on Christmas?
Actually a Christmas
Dark
movie.
Angel.
A.K.A. You'll Leave in Pieces.
You'll Leave in Pieces?
You Leave in Pieces.
Yes, it is December. It is Christmas time.
Wow. It's been too long. So I just remember being fascinated by the Flying Killer CDs.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh,
Very of its time. An alien comes down from space and is killing people with his flying CD thing.
And he's an alien drug dealer.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah.
He's dousing people with heroin and then pulling the liquid out of their head because in space that is a very much sought after potent drug.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Jocelyn. I did not vet these lists. You know? It might be actually.
I watching Better Watch Out, talking about like twists and everything, like has enough people seen? I really enjoyed it.
Oh, right.
There were a couple choices that I was like, is that intentional or is that just like all of the doorknobs on all of the doors are super high?
Super high up.
And it makes them all look so short. It really bothered me. And I'm like, it made them all look like a forced perspective Lord of the Rings, were all hobbits.
I think they shot it in Australia. And I was like, are doorknobs up that high in Australia?
Speak for the continent you're not from.
Like,
are doorknobs that high?
At forehead level.
No, the problem is they had a period in the 80s where dingoes were actually breaking into homes.
Sure. No, I've seen
easy
those
movies.
Because Meryl Streep exposed it to all of us. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so that was an anti-dingo thing. Yeah.
Are you serious? Are you? I can't even tell.
Yeah.
Are you being serious?
He's not.
I'm so glad you brought that up because I was sitting in a screening and I was like, that doorknob's really high. And everybody's like, shh, quiet, Turek.
And then there was another thing where they opened the door and the door handle was really high. And I was like, is the director trying to make them seem like children? I can't figure this out if this is intentional or not.
I will say, without being a spoiler, I'll say that's funny. My feeling about that film's funny because it does such a good job of making me like the two lead characters
and then it turns. Yeah.
I actually like the movie less, but it's because it's done its job so well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's a really – and maybe on a second viewing it might help, but I love those characters.
It becomes a very mean movie.
Yeah, no, it's not very mean
early on. And then,
no, I love the boy and the girl, the better.
Yeah.
So good.
Because it's got those great twists. But yeah, I remember what you're saying is that basically the whole time I was like, I don't know if I like this anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't like it. And it really is going to hinge on your ending. And so I thought they did a good enough job with the ending that I was like – I think I'm okay with this now.
Yes.
Because it does go in really dark, nasty territory.
But yeah, great, good babysitter.
Reminder, you care about the Scanners 3, The Takeover also.
Wait, that was a Turek.
Turek's trying to find elves.
I found the elves kid.
No, that's what it was.
Hold on, I think we have an audio clip now from Turek.
Gramps is a Nazi.
our sound guy looked worried the whole time. But I think we pulled it off.
I think we pulled it off. I think we did. All right.
That's pretty funny. I don't know if we can top this, Brian.
Yeah, this might be
it. Guys, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having
thanks
us.
Thank you, guys.
Becca, where can we find your film?
So we are currently in Redbox, Walmart, Target. We are on VOD platforms. We're also on Vudu.
iTunes, Vudu, Amazon now.
We're on Shudder as of December 13th.
The 13th, next
Thursday.
Would you
say all places you get movies?
Please specify that Walmart and Redbox are the DVD.
That's
yes.
Right.
The Blu-ray.
The Blu-ray's coming
for
January
for collectors
8th.
Like me.
That's correct.
Will be January, and there's a super fun commentary.
We had a lot of fun with their commentary,
doing,
for sure.
Which was also taped by Ernie. Hi, Ernie.
I know.
Ernie's
the
there
best.
For that. So, yeah. And, we have a commentary track on it, and you'll see a lot of prior Shockwaves guests in it. The majority of them
can
are
I just
in there.
Say I read a review the other day where they said the movie had a lot of genre notables, and the first fucking name under genre notables is not any of the actors in the movie, it's Elric Kane.
That's right.
Yes.
I think I wrote to Beck after going, I'm selling you tickets. Because the person watched it a second time to spot me, and I said, I don't know if that's worth
it. First cast member mentioned is Elric Kane.
I was well placed as an extra. I'm an extra in that
he's
movie.
Right
I'm not
in the front row. And
plays
in
by himself, I
one
think.
One of the reviews said, I had to rewind back to make sure it was Elric Kane and it was him. And Elric took a picture and sent it to me and was like, yeah, I'm selling tickets now. I'm selling your tickets.
We're extremely grateful to you and all the others who showed up.
Way you go.
I mean, and Chelsea and Sean get a full, double, two shot of them. And,
so does Mendez. He gets a pretty good one. Yeah.
Jared. Yeah, Mendez actually, I think, gets a laugh because he looks so weird sitting up there.
Axel and Jared are in it. Yeah, a lot of Shockwaves.
Yes.
So, But thank you guys so much for coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Jocelyn,
thank you.
Please come back after your next movie so we can talk about your whole career.
Awesome. Now, we can say that you are in Dr. Sleep.
Yes.
We just can't talk about it.
She's wearing a bear suit.
that's the headline. I'm wearing a bear suit.
She plays the hedge maze.
All right, guys. Thanks so much. We'll be back next week.